Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And finally tonight, the world through his lens. Jeffrey Brown has a look at the extraordinary journey of photographer Gordon Parks.
Two children with a doll. Who are they, and what are their lives like? A young man walking away from us. Where is he coming from, and where is he going? Armed with his camera, Gordon Parks told stories of individuals and, through them, of the larger world.
He had fantastic ability to compose a series of elements within a picture to, convey a sense of a story.
Philip Brookman is curator of Gordon Parks, The New Tide, an exhibition at the National Gallery of Art in Washington. Spanning the first 10 years of his career, from 1940 to 1950, it's a chance to see how a young man, self-taught and without a high school diploma, became one of the 20th century's master artists.
Parks came to an understanding, really before he ever picked up a camera, that it could be a tool for him to use to be able to express his own feelings about his life.
Gordon Parks was born in Fort Scott, Kansas in 1912, the youngest of 15 children. He credited his mother, Sarah, who died when he was 16, with giving him confidence and strength, even growing up amid poverty and prejudice. Parks spoke of his childhood in a 1997 NewsHour interview.
The disadvantage sometimes pushes you, if you use it right, because you want to rid yourself of those things that hurt you emotionally when you're coming up.
Inspired by the work of Dorothea Lange, Walker Evans, and other Depression-era photographers he saw in magazines, Parks first picked up a camera at the age of 25. In St. Paul and then Chicago, he took portraits, including Marva Trotter Lewis, a performer, model, and wife of boxer Joe Lewis. He befriended and photographed leading African-American artists and scholars, including Langston Hughes, Charles White, Elaine Locke. And he did his first journalism, covering Eleanor Roosevelt's visit to a Southside community center. Parks called the camera his choice of weapons.
Gordon Parks always had a sense that that media, that the camera and photography and writing and media could be a very important tool in helping the world to understand the image of African-American people. And it was through that understanding that you could make the world a better place.
In 1942, Parks was awarded a prestigious fellowship, allowing him to work as a photographer for the Farm Security Administration. His first assignment, documenting African-American life in Washington, D.C., then a deeply segregated city. Among his early works, this photo of a young boy who lost his leg in a streetcar accident.
I was really struck by, how intense the relationships are in the picture.
The relationships between photographer...
Relationships between the photographer and the boy, but also the relationship between the boy and the two girls sitting across the street.
Yeah.
These are things that Parks put them there for us to find.
Yeah.
And he knew he was doing them.
It was here Parks created one of his most famous photos, a portrait of Ella Watson, a cleaning lady in a government building.
I'd first ask her about her life, what it was like, and it was so disastrous that I just felt that I must photograph this woman and in a way that would make me feel, or make the public feel about what Washington, D.C. was in 1942.
The now iconic image, called American Gothic after the famed painting by Grant Wood, was part of a larger series on Watson, her family, and community. An extended photo essay style that Parks would go on to use throughout his career.
Parks often, he would meet people and he would talk to them. He would learn their stories. He would understand who they were, you know, long before he would ever bring along a camera. He was able to use his own experiences and his own struggles to understand and empathize with others.
In 1944, Standard Oil hired Parks as a photographer. He would continue to hone his craft and earn his first real paycheck, traveling around the country shooting scenes and portraits like this one of an oil worker at the Panola grease plant in Pittsburgh.
What he's done is he's created a portrait of a heroic African-American worker working for Standard Oil. You know, this is an amazingly, you know, technical photograph to produce. And, you know, in a very short time, Parks has learned, you know, the skills, mastered those skills.
He photographed white fishermen and farmers, black pilots training for war, and he continued to break barriers. In 1949, he was hired as the first black staff photographer at Life magazine, where his photo essays included one on a Harlem gang member named Red Jackson. He also traveled internationally, shooting high fashion spreads in Paris and celebrities like Ingrid Bergman in Italy. In 1950, he returned to his childhood home in Fort Scott to shoot a series for the magazine. And all of this was just the beginning. Parks would go on to write several memoirs and novels, to direct films including Shaft and an adaptation of his book The Learning Tree, and to compose music while continuing to work as a photographer.
He never understood that he wasn't supposed to do it. He just did it.
Gordon Parks died in 2006 at the age of 93. The exhibition Gordon Parks, The New Tide is on through February 18th. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown at the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
The child was as black as a raisin, and her hair looked like it had been burnt in the desert.
The new book, Genesis Begins Again, is about a 13-year-old African-American girl who dreams of having smooth hair and skin many shades closer to her light-skinned mother and grandmother. Genesis says a prayer every night, "Lord, turn it good." The prejudice and colorism she encounters don't just come from strangers or kids at school. Her own family judges her for her dark skin. The book is for children around Genesis's age. It's the first book that Alicia Williams has ever written. By day, Williams is a teacher, and she told me that she relates to Genesis personally, and she's seen kids like Genesis in the classroom.
In kindergarten, every year we will have our kids come in, whether they're Indian or African or African-American, they will come in, and we in our classrooms would be multicultural crayons. Never, never, never do our kids of color choose a skin tone that's close to theirs. They go as light as possible. So even when we try to encourage them to, okay, honey, just how about this brown one? They would never, never, never shade it in hard.
What do you say to a kindergartner who is choosing a lighter colored crayon because they don't want to draw their own skin color as dark as it is?
This was the hardest part. But with the teacher I was working with, we would definitely, you know, honey, this is your color. And we would show, oh, this is my color. First model that how it looks on us. Oh, look at my skin. I found the perfect color. But when the resistance is still there, I will find these ways to say, oh, my goodness, I just love your skin. It's so pretty. Oh, my goodness, when you color it, I just love it. So those encouraging words. And when there's other students around that might hear that, I'll find something else to compliment them on. So not to make them feel any less than, but I just wanted to find little seeds to build them up.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking Toni Morrison wrote The Bluest Eye in 1970. And it deals with some of the same themes. A character with dark skin is made to feel that she's ugly. She develops low self-esteem. Do you think we're still more or less where we were when that book was published almost 50 years ago?
Oh my gosh, yes. Yes. I've seen it growing up, not just within my family. I've seen it within, you know, our community. And it's unfortunate that even you think, okay, the thing like the brown bag doesn't happen. And oh no, no one still goes around measuring the color of a baby's ears to see how dark they'll be or the cuticles.
I should mention, the brown bag, this is something where you hold a bag up to a child or a person's skin and see whether they are the color of the brown paper bag or lighter or darker.
Yes, the brown bag. Thank you for explaining that. Whether it be a brown bag or a measuring, looking at the darkest part of a child, still having this idea, oh, honey, this is how dark your baby is going to be. And it's a negative connotation that you don't want your baby to be that dark. But that's it. We still talk about light skin versus dark skin. We still do that. So, yes, we're still in the same place. When we have on hashtag team light skin and hashtag team dark skin, and that's for our kids who still use social media, it's like this whole thing starts all over again each generation.
You know, there's not a lot of risk in pointing out racism outside of your own community, but when you portray racism within somebody's immediate family, you know, somebody's parents, somebody's grandparents, judging them based on how light or dark skinned they are, that seems risky. That seems dangerous. Like it's a thing you don't do. And in this book, you do it.
I'm terrified.
Really?
I'm so terrified. You know how you say you don't talk about this in front of white folks. You don't let them know what's going on in your house. Mm-hmm. I'm nervous about giving people words or ammunition.
Yeah.
I'm so nervous because as a writer, you start thinking, is this going to be a good thing? Will I do more damage or will I help? Am I going to help? Because the whole thing was, how can I help heal some children? How can I heal them? How can I let them know they're good enough? Not just the ones that is dealing with colorism, but will they get that it's not just colorism that I want to heal them from, but to let them know they're good enough, whether they're tall or short, that they're, you know, there's going to be somebody that's picking on them and saying, you're not going to be, you know, you're going to be in a box. You have your Jewish uncle's nose and you have your red hair like your Irish auntie and you have those freckles that won't ever go away. You know, there's always something that we're across each ethnicity. There's always something. And I know my story is through colorism. So I'm just so nervous, though, that we'll focus on this minute thing and not see the broadness of it.
Given your fear, given the potential that people could use this as ammunition, what made you decide that it was important to do this anyway?
I saw children directly affected by colorism. I saw friends. I still felt the residue for myself. And I started developing different ideas about it. Whether, people receive it or not, I know my intention and the impact that I want is to heal some people. It may not be for everyone, but I have to heal somebody. You know, they say that there's one good book in you. I hope that this is not the only one, but this is a story. This is a story because this is something I needed to hear. I needed to hear that, okay, it's not going to happen overnight that I'm going to love myself, but you know, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay.
There's an interesting thing you do in this book where over the course of the story, you kind of sprinkle a trail of breadcrumbs of almost a reading list. You mention The Color Purple, Up from Slavery, the autobiography of Malcolm X. An alert reader could walk away from this with a stack of books that they want to read next.
It's so hilarious. I wasn't thinking about it when I wrote it, but that was brought up to me. And I'm thinking, yes, because I read these books and I look at the characters. There are even more because that was edited out. But if we were going to teach Genesis, we can definitely put a playlist together as well as some books together.
Yeah, because you mentioned a playlist. This book name drops so many musicians from Nina Simone to Billie Holiday and Etta James, so many of the greats. If we're going to go out on a piece of music, what would you like us to play?
Billie Holiday, I wrote through the manuscript to her, majority of it. Billie Holiday, God bless the child.
Alicia Williams, her debut novel is called Genesis Begins Again. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Ari. I so appreciate it.
Them that's got shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is new.
Well, the future is uncertain for Bennett College. The historically black school for women is at risk of losing its accreditation if it can't provide proof of financial stability. The HBCU has been on probation for 2 years, but was caught off guard by a decision made last month by a regional accreditor who deemed it out of financial compliance. The school quickly launched a grassroots campaign to raise $5 million by February 1st. Bennett College President Phyllis Worthy Dawkins will make the case for keeping the school's doors open at a hearing next month. WUNC reporter Naomi Prilo has been following the story and joins us now. Naomi, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back to this announcement that was made, actually the vote, technically, and I guess formally, the school has lost its accreditation but is in an appeal process, right? So maybe you can explain that for us.
Yeah, so they are still accredited for now, but the announcement really caught them off guard because Bennett officials thought that they were doing well. They had an enrollment increase, and they had made some financial gains. So this kind of came out of left field for them.
Talk about the probation. How was it that they got put on probation, or what were the conditions that led to that?
Just financial instability. They had been in a deficit, and it just kind of seemed like history, the history of the school with declining retention rate, low enrollment, layoffs, in deficits. It all kind of led up to this and showed the accrediting agency that they weren't really doing all that well.
So they go on probation, and of course the thought is that you will turn things around over that 2 year period. Then this announcement that they really have less time than they thought. Tell us how things have been going over that period. In other words, how has Bennett today, and how does it compare to the time when they were put on probation?
Well, as far as students on campus, they're feeling a mixture of emotions. Some are feeling that they're going to reach their goal. Others are feeling cautiously optimistic. They definitely hope that Bennett will reach their goal, but they're also thinking, do I need to start looking at other schools? What's going to happen when I graduate? That sort of thing. And Bennett officials, the college, they're just remaining very optimistic. There is no sort of, well, we may not make it. They're saying, yes, we're going to make it this entire time.
I mean, it's tough for students. They're in an appeals process now, and as I understand it, that process will go on at least through the end of this year, so that, in other words, if you're in the school and graduating this year, you would graduate from an accredited school. But you can understand the anxiety of students going to a school.
Definitely.
And wondering, you know, what kind of school they're going to graduate from. But Bennett did announce two big donations last week. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so last week they received $1 million in donations. One was $500,000 from the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, which is out of Winston-Salem, and the other was $500,000 from the Papa John's Foundation. So that definitely gave them an increase. Right now, they're at $3.1 million out of their $5 million campaign.
And tell us about this. This $5 million is a threshold they set, right? This
yes.
is what Bennett is hoping would appease the accreditation agency and the judges. They raised it now. Papa John's, of course, there's a little bit of controversy around that, right?
Yes. Papa John's, after their former CEO had used the N-word, a lot of the black community was just not happy with it, as they should be. So some black people have been seeing this as a huge PR stunt. Some critics are saying all money isn't good money. Why are you accepting this? But Bennett officials feel that because Papa John's is under new leadership, that they're being very genuine, that they've turned a new leaf. So they weren't hesitant or reluctant at all to accept the money.
All right, so there it is. And that donation and the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation, part of the organizations that have chosen to stand with Bennett, and that is a campaign. So tell us more about that campaign.
Stand with Bennett is a campaign that started pretty much immediately after the announcement in December. It started as a hashtag, and since then, it's all over shirts. It's gone viral. A lot of black news publications have been talking about Stand With Bennett. Celebrities have tweeted it. these students and alumni, they really love their college. They really love Bennett College. And so they don't want to see it lose its accreditation. They want to see it succeed and prosper. So they're doing everything that they can.
Well, we're talking about Bennett College now, a school at risk of losing its accreditation unless it can prove financial stability. I'm talking with WUNC Greensboro Bureau reporter Naomi Prelo. And joining the conversation now is Bethany Chafin. She's a reporter at public radio station WFDD. Welcome, Bethany. Good to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
You spoke with the president of Bennett College, Phyllis Worthy Dawkins, about the, and other than the Stand With Bennett campaign. How does she think she's going to find this money, and how optimistic is she?
She's very optimistic, as Naomi was saying. There's no if we do this or will we do this. It is when we do this. So she is making sure that all of her language is very optimistic. A few things they're hoping they don't have to do, but they're looking at, is the possibility of liquidating some of their assets. That includes parts of the art collection and some of their land. Again, that's sort of a last resort. They're hoping that doesn't have to happen. The other thing they're doing is they're looking for some forgiveness on some of their debt.
Tell us about the $5 million. Who set that mark, and why is that the magic number?
Exactly. So President Dawkins said this is a very complicated algorithm at which they use to arrive at this number. But as you all were mentioning earlier, this is really Bennett College's estimation of what they need. Their accrediting body did not necessarily say when they put them on probation, you have to raise this amount, you have to do this and this. They basically said you're out of compliance due to your financial resources, and you need to be in compliance by this date. So that's a little bit difficult to say, well, how will we know when we're there? But Bennett has decided that $5 million cash in the bank will be what will help them headed into this appeals meeting.
Naomi was talking about some of the underlying problems. Maybe you can go into a little more detail. Low enrollment, student retention. Talk about some of the underlying problems.
Exactly. So Bennett College's enrollment in 2010 was 780 students. Today, they have 471 full-time students. So obviously a big dip in enrollment. Also, retention rates. As Naomi was saying, the past few years have shown improvement in both of these things, but probably not enough to encourage the possibility that this will be a sustainable institution into the future. But, you know, small private institutions have a lot of challenges these days. They're competing against larger public institutions that have bigger endowments. Also, these institutions are able to offer an education for less money. And even across state lines, some institutions are able to say, we'll match what you might be able to get in state. There's a lot that Bennett is facing right now that they are trying to overcome.
And this is really the paradox, especially of HBCUs, right? The reason why want to go there. The value of this is because we're small. The value of this is because we're a historically black institution that understands our population better than perhaps other institutions might. But that means that you're competing, as you say, with those institutions who also want well-qualified students.
Exactly. Over the weekend, there was an event. It was a conversation between Reverend Barber and his daughter, who graduated from Bennett College. And I thought she put it really nicely. She said there really aren't that many institutions these days that are built around pouring resources and building up black women. And so that because of that, she called Bennett College a really sacred institution.
Talk a little bit more about the campaign itself. How is that, you know, the campaign to raise the money? Obviously looking for big donors, but what about small donors? Donations, and how is that working?
Yeah, President Dawkins was really humbled when I talked to her about the grassroots effort she was seeing. She said daily they were getting hundreds of donations, and those were ranging from a few dollars to, $100,000, and now we've had the bigger gifts come in at $500,000. So she said because HBCUs are normally very much a part of the community in which they're situated, you're seeing a lot of local support. You know, she said you'll see efforts at the local barbershop, at the local grocery store. So everyone is really coming together, especially local churches. Bennett College has a history with the Methodist Church. So you're seeing a lot of leaders of faith coming together to support Bennett.
We'll have a link at our website and show you how you want to get involved if that's something you want to do. Naomi, give us a sense of the mood on campus. You touched on it earlier, but give us a broader sense of what's happening.
Yeah, the mood on campus is just optimism, but cautious optimism. All of the students that I spoke with, they're very proud to be Bennett Bells. They're very proud of their school. They love their school. They are all about positivity. We're going to reach this goal by Friday. There's no question about it. But then others are like, it's scary. Yeah. We hope that we can get it, but this is a scary time for us, and it's kind of difficult for us to focus on our studies. But it's a mixture.
Well, I want to thank you both for your reporting. Naomi Prelo is a Greensboro Bureau reporter for WUNC. Bethany Chafin is a reporter for WFDD in Winston-Salem. Thank both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Well, see, again, the people who classify themselves as white are not happy with their appearance. Now, they've taught us to be unhappy about our appearance. You see, but they're very unhappy about their appearance. I think there's an article in the handout about a woman who was, white woman who was in Hawaii, and she said that being around the Hawaiian people and the Asian people, and she said she was tall and white and pale. She said she felt like a freak. And so then she started getting involved in genetic science.
A Chinese scientist stunned the world last year when he announced that he had created the first gene-edited babies. Now, NPR has learned about a new experiment aimed at creating gene-edited human embryos. It's being conducted by a scientist in the United States. Let's be clear, he is not trying to make genetically modified babies yet, but that could be the ultimate goal. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein brings us this exclusive story from inside the scientist's lab.
It's early in the morning at one of Columbia University's research towers in New York City. I meet Dieter Egli in his office on the sixth floor.
Hi, Rob Stein from NPR.
You're coming with the microphone.
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry.
I guess that's your job. That's what you do.
Yeah, we have to kind of record every little thing for our stories.
Egli leads me down the hall to a tiny windowless room. It's jammed with scientific equipment, two microscopes, lab dishes. He's going to show me how he's trying to fix mutations in human embryos.
I'm going to wear gloves because we want to keep things clean.
Egli wants to know if it's really possible to use the revolutionary gene editing technique known as CRISPR to safely repair genes in human embryos. Egli is trying to repair a genetic defect that causes blindness to maybe, someday, help blind people carrying the mutation have children who can see.
Preventing inherited forms of blindness would be wonderful, very important for affected families.
One big reason the world condemned the Chinese scientist is he rushed ahead without doing enough careful research first to prove it works and is safe.
We can't just do the editing and then hope everything goes right and implant that into a womb. That's not responsible. We have to first do the basic research to see what happens. That's what we're doing here.
But even just doing the basic research to see if this might be possible is really controversial. But more about that later. Right now, Egli is ready to start his editing experiment. He turns to a big black microscope behind him and slides a round glass dish under the lens. That dish contains the CRISPR gene editing tool, along with sperm from a blind man who carries the defect that Egli is trying to fix. Egli gently adds a human egg to the dish.
I'm starting with just one egg. You'll be able to see it shortly once I go to higher magnification.
I can see everything he's doing under the microscope, magnified on a computer monitor.
The big round thing is the egg. Looks like the moon.
Yeah, it's a beautiful cell. I would say it's one of the most beautiful cells.
Egli maneuvers a tiny glass needle towards one of the sperm.
So you can see a moving sperm over here. I'm picking it up. Sperm is in the needle. Now I'm dipping it in the CRISPR tool.
Once the sperm is inside the needle with the CRISPR gene editing tool, Egli points the needle's tip at the egg.
Oh, no. Oh, no. The sperm is swimming away. Oh, here it is.
Once that runaway sperm's back in the needle, Egli pierces the egg.
Membrane is broken. Breached. There we go. Sperm and CRISPR tool in the egg.
Oh, you did it. You got it.
Yeah, got it.
It's nerve-wracking.
Very.
The idea is that CRISPR will slice out the mutation in the sperm, and the healthy DNA in the egg will fix it.
Hopefully, the CRISPR tool will cut the mutation, and then the egg will replace that with a version that no longer causes disease. The genome from the mother would be rescuing the mutant genome from the father.
Scientists in Oregon who developed this approach are also trying to prove the technique can safely fix genetic mutations in human embryos, including one of the breast cancer genes.
Okay, next.
For the next 2 hours, Eggly painstakingly fertilizes and edits one egg after another.
There we go. That one definitely worked. Beautiful.
It may be beautiful to Eggly, but this kind of research is making some people very nervous.
This is really disturbing.
Fyodor Ornov is a scientist at the Altius Institute for Biomedical Sciences in Seattle. He worries this kind of research will encourage more scientists to go rogue and misuse this technology.
As we've learned from the events in China, it is no longer a hypothetical that somebody will just go ahead and go rogue and do something dangerous, reckless, unethical. Anyone with a connection to the internet will be able to download the recipe to make a designer baby. And then the question becomes, what's to prevent them from using it? And as we learned in the past year, apparently nothing.
So Ernoff wants a halt to such research until scientists can figure out how to prevent more abuse.
We need to hit the pause button and keep it pressed until we understand how do we proceed in a way that minimizes the risk of people going rogue.
And society has had a chance for a broad debate about whether there's really any good reason to ever try to make any more gene-edited babies when there are so many other ways to prevent genetic diseases. But many others disagree.
This is valid research, and I think it's important research.
Alta Charo is a bioethicist at the University of Wisconsin.
It has value not only for the possible use in the future for some number of conditions that would involve a live birth, but it has value for basic understanding of embryology, basic understanding of human development. Of course, I think you should be doing that research. Why wouldn't you do that research?
2 hours later, back in Eggly's lab.
Okay, that's it. That's the last one.
14 fertilized and edited eggs are safely back in storage.
Wow, so that was a lot of work.
Yeah, wow, that... it was.
Eggly stresses he's nowhere near trying to make any gene-edited babies this way. He stops his embryos from developing right away to study them.
Right now we're not trying to make babies. We are working with human embryos for research purposes only. None of these cells will go into the womb of a person.
What if it does work safely, Eggly says? This gene editing could someday prevent a long list of horrible diseases. Tay-Sachs, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's, not make designer babies.
If we ultimately find ways to prevent diseases, that will be wonderful.
While this debate rages, the National Academies of Science and Medicine, the World Health Organization, and others are trying to come up with tougher guidelines for how scientists could safely and ethically edit human embryos. Rob Stein, NPR News, New York.
An intense debate is underway over the benefits and drawbacks of human microchips. They're already used to identify ranch animals and pets. But the practice of implanting chips in people is also on the rise. Those who embrace the idea say they see it as a way to take back control of their personal data. But others are worried about how that data could be used. Special correspondent Malcolm Brabant reports from southern England. It's part of our Breakthrough series on the leading edge of science, technology, and medicine.
I don't want to live a normal life. I want to live an exceptional life, and I want to try things and do things that perhaps others in my situation have never done.
Meet Alex Lewis, interior designer, businessman, adventurer, and motivational speaker.
We were just an ordinary family. Me, Lucy, and our son Sam.
Then, just over 2 years ago, I caught a common cold.
It was to change the course of my life overnight.
I'm in this condition thanks to an incredibly rare case of strep A, and it led to toxic shock syndrome, septicemia, and subsequently sepsis. I lost all four limbs within about 6 or 7 months.
Alex is a pathfinder for those with serious medical conditions. In the remains of each arm, a microchip has been implanted. One is to hold medical information, the other for a chore the able-bodied take for granted.
For me, as a prosthetic user, one of the most fiddly things is keys. keys are a nightmare for us. And the microchip, when looking into it, we realised quite quickly that it could save a lot of time. So for me, it was going to be beneficial for that. I could lose 15 minutes trying to get in my front door. I could lose 10 minutes trying to get out of my back door. And now all that's been saved.
These microchips use a system called near-field communication. It's exactly the same sort of technology used in contactless debit and credit cards. Like the bank cards, the chip's information can be scanned, but it cannot transmit. Once banking security has been configured, developers believe consumers will soon be free to spend with the implant. A British railway ticket, but it's much different in Sweden, a country supposedly leading the microchip revolution. On Sweden's high-speed rail lines, for the past 18 months, implanted passengers have put their travel payment on the chip.
I think it's really good with a chip ticket. I love all companies that use the chip technology.
But the rail company is stopping the experiment. The number of implanted passengers is relatively small, and it wants to pursue other forms of ticketing. This is not a setback, insists Sweden's microchip pioneer Johan Österlund, a former body piercer seen here giving a TED talk.
We can do easier travel. We can do faster and safer payment. We can do something as mundane as opening a door. I mean, the opportunities are endless.
Unfortunately, these innovators often don't think about the political ramifications.
Gus Hussain is the executive director of Privacy International, a non-profit that challenges overreaching state and corporate surveillance.
In today's world particularly, we have to imagine how governments and how ambitious politicians and even ambitious corporate executives will try to imagine putting this type of technology into you so that they can exploit your data and ultimately exploit you.
I'm going to ask you to keep your hand just nice and relaxed like it is.
IT student Kieran Anderson is being chipped by Dr. Jeff Watson, a consultant anaesthetist who's driving research into the medical benefits.
The microchip's actually inside here. And there's a sort of introducer piece of plastic that will push it out once it's in. Okay, so this is the implant coming now. You'll feel a bit of pressure. And a bit of a clunk. So you're now a cyborg. Welcome.
Not too painful?
No, that's fine.
Kieran has a near-field communication microchip in his hand, and that can be used to store data, store information, his name, address, contact details, anything he chooses to put on there, blood type, allergies, basic medical information.
The idea of everything being able to commute together excites me quite a lot. So, you know, automatic payments and that sort of thing without you having to actually do anything.
The idea of this chip is that it's not transmitting anything. It has to be actively read. You choose who can read it and when they can read it. I think that that gives us a lot more personal control over our information than your mobile phone is giving away.
But Privacy International's Gus Hussain is yet to be convinced.
Already governments are keen to capture your fingerprints. They are keen to capture your iris scans, and they want to be able to do this at a distance so they can identify as you walk through areas. They're doing facial recognition. These are all fallible technologies. They're hard to do well. But the idea that they could actually just embed you, it is the modern form of tattooing barcodes on people, and we've seen governments do that in the past. This is just the next generation.
Stephen Northam, the co-owner of the British implant company, believes those fears are exaggerated.
So I've been compared to Hitler before for microchipping people. It's been commented, but I mean, I can't really see the connection personally. I can understand people have very strong views. There's big ethical arguments around microchipping people, but currently it's by choice. No one is enforcing you have to be microchipped. If that happens, completely different ball game and lots more arguments to be had around it.
Eddie Curry favours using chips to replace keys at his weekly newspaper on England's southern coast. He fears the publication is at risk in the changing global media market and wants to attract new income by turning the company into a hub for digital innovators.
I'm well aware that this technology could be used for all sorts of sinister things, but for us here, we're an ethical firm. We don't envisage doing anything more than that, and we wouldn't force anybody to have one because we can understand they may be reticent about it.
but the majority of staff have rejected the offer to be chipped.
The benefits, of just being able to open a door wouldn't really be sufficient for me to have something implanted in my body.
Well, I haven't got any concerns because obviously this is quite a small company and I don't think it will be abused here.
I suppose somebody has got to be the trailblazer so that other people can see how it works. I don't want that to be me.
Jeff Watson sees huge potential, especially in the medical field, for those with illnesses such as diabetes.
Take a diabetic who collapses in the street and people don't know what to do. By the time the ambulance has arrived and worked things out, it may take hours before they're properly treated. Whereas a simple instruction read from the phone, my name is Joe Bloggs, please contact this number for my next of kin. I'm diabetic, please give me some sugar and it should make me feel better. Those kind of things could make life-changing advances for individuals.
The chips can be read by scanners installed in the latest mobile phones. So how easy would it be for a hacker to steal the information from the implants used by Alex and others?
Any technology is open to abuse, and anybody would be able to hack it. In order to hack these devices, it has to be held still for a period of time. At the moment, I think that takes about 3 to 4 hours to hack it.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
Alex's wife, Lucy, is not troubled by security concerns and is looking forward to the second generation of chips.
Alex travels overseas an awful lot. Before he goes overseas, I have to do this whole packaging of medication, what medication he's on, and passports. I'm always worried about who has his passport. And so all of those things, it will eventually come into its own that he'll be able to use all of that information without me worrying about where it is or who it's with.
At present, Alex Lewis relies on a driver, but he hopes the next breed of implants will put him behind the wheel.
To be able to get into the car, to start it without any kind of key with the microchip to start the car would be fantastic. But it just opens up a bit more freedom for me.
Privacy International's Gus Hossain insists he's not a Luddite, a person opposed to new technology.
Every technology that comes along has to be treated with complete suspicion until we're able to sort out the ethical barriers around our actions.
I live an incredible life, a life that I'm incredibly happy to be living.
As this technology improves, the debate will intensify as to whether implants generate or diminish freedom, as well as the many shades of grey in between. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Malcolm Brabant in southern England.
You know, First Ladies usually have a cause. And you've already said you're interested in speaking out against bullying on social media.
I think it's very important because a lot of children and teenagers are getting hurt, and we need to teach them how to talk to each other, how to treat each other, and to be able to connect with each other on the right way.
It's an ironic choice, since her own husband sent out a stream of pretty nasty tweets during the campaign.
They're exposing a social media post that's led to an internal investigation involving a Detroit police officer, and it's a story you'll only see on Action News. Police are looking into comments the officer allegedly made involving a woman he pulled over. Simon Shaycat shows us why the woman says she's the victim of racism and what prior trouble the law we found in the officer's past.
Detroit police are calling what happened completely inappropriate and problematic, and they've now launched an internal investigation over what took place during a traffic stop here.
Priceless.
Take a close look at this video, temporarily posted to the social media site Snapchat, following a Detroit police traffic stop near Joy Road and Stout Tuesday night.
Walk of shame. In the cold.
Listen closely as the officer makes condescending remarks towards an African-American girl he's instructed to walk home in the cold. We've confirmed she was pulled over for having expired license tabs.
Bye, Felicia.
Notice in the upper left corner of the screen, the officer shares his Snapchat name. Detroit police confirm his real name is Gary Steele, the man seen in this public LinkedIn page.
What they put on there, that's racist. Like, they demeaned my child for no reason.
We showed this video to Arielle Moore, the young woman who was videotaped on a cell phone, and her mother, Monique Mobley. They're now sharing their outrage over his words and captions that read, quote, what black girl magic looks like, and celebrating Black History Month.
I've never had this happen to me in my life, so I'm kind of shocked. Don't really know how to feel right now. Still trying to take it in.
I will order that the defendant be segregated from the general population.
Also disturbing, Officer Steele's prior trouble with the law. Prosecutors charged him with physically attacking his ex-girlfriend and firing a gun next to her head back in 2008. The incident in Canton ended with Steele taking a misdemeanor plea deal for probation and staying on the force. He's declined to speak with us for this story.
We've also confirmed that officer has since been taken off the street, placed on restricted duty. We will stay on top of this to make sure that he is held accountable. Simon Shaquette, 7 Action News.
Nigga!
When the New England Patriots first emerged as a Super Bowl winner in this era, it was not at all clear that they were a dynasty on the rise. That was nearly 20 years ago, and the Patriots were actually the underdog against what was then the St. Louis Rams. This Sunday, the Patriots are going for a 6th championship, and the Rams, who have since moved to Los Angeles, would love to even the score. But as Amna Nawaz tells us, the league has still not fully come to terms with the fallout of the Colin Kaepernick story and his protests against police brutality and racial inequality.
There's no doubt it was a big year for the NFL. Ratings were up this season. Teams scored more as offenses kicked into another gear. But the reaction to Kaepernick and how the league has responded keeps coming up. NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell had to address it. And many musicians, including reportedly Rihanna, turned down a chance to perform the halftime show, a premier event seen by tens of millions. The band Maroon 5 did agree to perform on Sunday. And they're now facing backlash of their own. Michael Fletcher of the ESPN's The Undefeated has been writing all about this and joins me now. Michael, welcome back to the NewsHour. You've written about this in your latest piece. There's two quarterbacks on the field on Sunday. There's a third everyone has been talking about, and that is Colin Kaepernick. The man rarely speaks publicly. He rarely gives interviews, if ever. Why are we still talking about him today?
I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, as you point out, it's been 2 years since Kaepernick played, but yet he kind of underlies a lot of the conversation and a lot of the angst, if you will, that surrounds the NFL. Like, as you point out, it's been kind of good times for the NFL. It broke a streak of ratings declines this year. The games have been exciting. The money continues to flow. But there's this troubling racial dynamic underlying the league, and I think Kaepernick represents that. The fact that he hasn't been signed, the protest that he ignited by kneeling during the national anthem, kind of revealed this kind of racial split among NFL fans. And that's something that the league is trying to hold together. And so far, so good. But it's clearly there's a tremor happening.
And clearly that racial divide persists, right? We've got a league that is majority players are African-American. Majority of the owners are white. There's still a lot of conversations around that. And we know Kaepernick has a grievance, right? An official complaint he's filed with the NFL saying that the owners colluded to keep him unsigned and out of the game. I want to ask you about something that Goodell actually said earlier this week, because, as we mentioned, he was asked about Kaepernick in what was supposed to be a press conference about the Super Bowl. But here's what he had to say when he was asked about why Kaepernick hasn't been signed.
Our clubs are the ones to make decisions on players that they want to have on their roster. They make that individually. They make that in the best interest of their team. And that's something that we as the NFL take pride in. If a team decides that Colin Kaepernick or any other player can help their team win, that's what they'll do.
So, Michael, what do you make of that response from Goodell? And do you think we're ever going to see Cap back on an NFL team?
Well, you know, Roger Goodell has been saying that for the last 2 years. That's been kind of his stock response. And the league doesn't go further in talking about, why Kaepernick's not on a team. But the Undefeated, we did a poll recently that sort of looked at this racial divide. I mean, black fans back Kaepernick. White fans don't back Kaepernick. And you sort of have that sort of right down the line. And you talk about people turning away from the game. More white fans are actually turning away from the game because of the whole Kaepernick protest movement, if you will, than black fans, even though both sides are kind of put off. So you can understand how team owners are kind of in a bind, in a sense. I mean, they're probably making a business decision, saying that we don't want to alienate fans by hiring this guy. And who knows? I mean, as far as Cap, ever playing again, I personally doubt it. I don't see a team signing him at this point. I think it'll be too much of a kerfuffle for them. He could well win his grievance and win tens of millions of dollars, but I don't imagine him playing. And he's had a good, he had a short career, but a good one, made over $40 million, and now he's kind of become almost a global figure, kind of a iconic figure, if you will, of resistance and protest.
So, Michael, I got to ask you, there is an actual game on Sunday now, right? You've got Tom Brady leading the Patriots.
Yeah, is that?
Yeah. Record 9th Super Bowl for him. You've got first-time Super Bowl quarterback there in Jared Goff on the other side for the Rams. What's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in the game?
You know, as a kid growing up, I loved Joe Namath. I was a Jets fan, so I have this antipathy toward the Patriots. But you can't bet against them. Belichick is too crafty. I think the Patriots are able to play different styles of football. Offensively, they may be able to control the ball against the Rams and ramp up time of possession. And if that's the case, I think the Rams lose. Another ring for Brady.
You think experience is going to win the day, huh?
I think so.
Michael Fletcher, a senior writer at ESPN's The Undefeated. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Little brother, I heard y'all ain't hitting in New York. Word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in L.A. Word, word. I heard y'all ain't hitting in North Carolina.
North Carolina.
Why are African Americans in Asheville more likely to be charged with resisting an officer than other residents? A new analysis from the Asheville Citizen Times shows that more than a third of resisting an officer charges are made against African Americans. The black population in Asheville is only about 12%. Joel Burgess is government accountability reporter for the Asheville Citizen-Times. He did the analysis, spoke with some experts and advocates to find out what is behind this disparity, and joins us now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Joel, welcome back.
Thanks much. Good to talk to you again, Frank.
Tell us what prompted you to take a deeper look at arrest records in Asheville.
Well, people might remember we had a police incident here that got exposed after we at the Citizen Times obtained a leaked police body camera video of an arrest back in 2017. It involved a white police officer named Christopher Hickman and a black pedestrian named Johnny Rush. And Rush was pulled over, well, stopped. He was walking for jaywalking and for cutting across a parking lot late at night, charged with trespassing. And the situation went downhill. Rush was beaten, shocked, choked, and he was charged with various crimes. And one of them was resisting an officer. It's also called resist, delay, obstruct, sometimes just known as RDO. And having worked in the area and in newspapers for quite a while now, I've seen this charge happen in a lot of arrest warrants. So we just got really curious. This charge against Rush was ultimately dismissed, but it seemed ironic looking at the footage and seeing him being pinned to the ground and beaten and shocked and choked. And it seemed like any resistance he was offering was to protect himself. So we went and did a public records request with the Asheville Police Department for the last 5 years of arrest records.
What did you find?
Well, we asked for it. By the way, in those 5 years, you had about 24,000 arrests. But we were particularly interested in arrests that involved the charge of resisting an officer. It's a Class 2 misdemeanor, by the way, in North Carolina. And we found that there were 1,800 of them. And I have to say that this was not entirely me. We had a data analyst named Michael McGlone, who was instrumental in helping sort through this stuff. It really was not very wieldy, we would say, if that's a way to put it. It was hard to deal with. And what we figured out is what you talked about in the opening, is that 35% of the arrests were of black people. And that's nearly triple the city's population of African Americans, which, as you said, was 12%. It just struck us. And another thing that we decided to look at was we created a subgroup, a subset, if you will, of people who had only been charged with resisting an officer. In other words, there's no other charge listed. It's possible there might have been a citation, we learned later, but it's an odd thing, and it's something that even police advocates say raises a red flag. And even Asheville Police Department officials say they prefer officers not to do. And we found there were 166 of those. which arguably, you know, may not be statistically significant. But the interesting thing is that it actually lined up. 34% of those charged with standalone RDOs were also black.
And again, compared to the population, a huge disparity. And we should probably clear this up a little bit because we think about that charge, and most commonly we use the phrase resisting arrest. And so it would seem preposterous that you could only be charged with resisting arrest, right? I mean, there must have been a precipitating factor. It's not quite that. It's resisting an officer, resist, delay, and obstruct. So spread it out and explain how anybody could be charged with that and nothing else.
Right. And thank you for making that point, because I even commonly called it resisting arrest until I read the statute and thought about it and talked with people about it. Well, there's some things that I think all of us would say, obviously, that's a person resisting an officer. An officer moves to arrest this person, they struggle. They run away after an officer says stop, and they clearly hear them and they understand that they are the subject of an investigation, or the officer wants to talk to them because of a crime. But there's other things that really we might not understand. For example, if you give an officer false information, maybe you're in a car with somebody and you give a wrong name, you give a different address. In some cases, simply walking away has been determined to be resisting an officer, though we found a case where that was not true. Because there has to be – if a person walks away, they have to understand that an officer is trying – to stop them. So it's the language is very broad, and because of that, a lot of civil rights advocates and have criticized it and said it's overly broad and it's subjective and it opens the door up for abuse.
Well, and it certainly does raise that question with this disparity that you've detected because of the data dive you've done. What are experts saying about that? You did talk to a number of people who tried to explain why. Again, given the subjectivity, you can imagine there just might be this sort of thing. What are they saying about it?
Well, an important thing to add on to about that subjectivity is the response that we got from, again, the police department itself and police advocates was that, yes, they agreed it could be subjective, but they said that was a necessary tool for them to deal with issues on the street. So that was an interesting response. But regarding a lot of other people, what we found is we talked to Frank Baumgartner, and I believe he's been a guest with you. He's a UNC Chapel Hill political science professor, and he's more of a specialist in traffic stops and the disparities that people are finding now, racial disparities in traffic stops around the state, including in Asheville. We've been looking at those too. And Baumgartner, I told him my statistics, and he said, my gosh. And he said, in fact, he too had done a brief study on this where he had looked statewide and found that there, as a matter of fact, is a disparity statewide also. But it's not – in terms of population, it's still not as great. You know, statewide, it's about twice the percentage population of black people in North Carolina. And again, in Asheville, it's nearly three times. And so he found that striking. And his attitude, you know, where we've gone with this is saying, look, there's a disparity. Let's talk to people about why. But Baumgartner has started drawing the link and saying it could be that black people are arresting more, but are resisting more, but I don't think so. And some civil rights advocates have said, look, it's more than that. It's predatory policing. And probably the worst case of this that we found and that people really already knew about, at least those who dug into the report on Ferguson, Missouri, we talked to a former prosecutor who got involved there, and people know that name. It's become just a watershed moment in racial politics in America. And Chirag Baines is the name of the former prosecutor. And he said that the disparity there was just – was really striking, and that they've started to call it contempt by cop or contempt of cop, excuse me. And the idea was that it seemed that officers, when they didn't like responses that they were getting from people, were charging them with resisting. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead, because I want to ask you, because in a number of cases, these resisting, especially the standalone, are dropped. And there's a fair percentage of them that are dropped. We can talk about that, but that doesn't necessarily mean good things either, because it can also be a leverage. So if it shouldn't have been brought in the first place and then a prosecutor can use it as leverage, well, I'll drop this, that's not necessarily a good thing if it never should have been brought in the first place.
Yeah, you know, of course, you go to court to – you're innocent until proven guilty – But even if charges are dismissed, they tend to stay with you. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain how we found they did in just a minute. But yes, you're right. More than we couldn't do all 1,800 of these RDO arrests. It was really the data from the courts was almost impossible to work with in that way. And that's a separate issue I'd love to talk to the administrative office of the courts about. But so we worked on that subset that, as you said, the 166 standalone arrests. And 57% of black defendants had their charges dismissed, 53% of white. As you said, it's commonly said among some police advocates that they know these charges are used as bargaining chips and they don't get that worked up about it when it happens. But in talking to one civil rights advocate, Ian Mance, who's with the Southern Coalition for Social Justice, he's an attorney. He said, well, that tells me that the prosecutor, the district attorney, doesn't think much about these charges. You know, he doesn't really value them very much or value the evidence. Our district attorney, Todd Williams, said he doesn't know how Mance came to that conclusion, but it's an interesting one to put out there. And one other expert I'll bring up too, who really did specialize in this, is a law professor named Scott Holmes, who's at North Carolina Central in Durham. And Scott, as a defense attorney before he became a professor, said that he started to see these charges, and along with other charges that he started to call a criminalization of poverty, public urination, second-degree trespassing. And he said he started mailing out letters, kind of like some attorneys do when they see traffic tickets. They have a system where they mail them out to offer to represent people. And in his motive, I don't think, was to make a lot of money. I think he felt a degree of outrage about this. But when he became a law professor, he had his students work on a project. And there in Durham, he found that, yes, there was a large disparity. Again, I don't think it was as much in Asheville's in terms of the percentage of population. But a conclusion, an interesting conclusion he came to, was that many of them did involve a feeling by officers that they were being disrespected, you know, a sense that there was a misunderstanding between the two parties. And it made me go back again and think about what spurred us to do this arrest of that black pedestrian Johnny Rush back in 2017. And I went back and listened again to the tape and listened to his interaction with police. And in fact, it was striking because there was a point at which one of the police officer trainees said to him, look at me. And Rush said, I don't have to. And another one in which the officer used the term punk, you're trying to punk me, which essentially is about respecting somebody or disrespecting somebody, really, is what that's talking about. It was just striking. So as part of this reporting that we did, I went back through and wrote the transcript of this portion of the arrest so people could kind of read it and understand this aspect that you have Holmes and other people saying plays a role in this charge.
Joel, thank you so much for your reporting and the deep dive. I know this is a continuing report and investigation with you. I deeply appreciate what you've done and certainly coming on to talk with us. It's not the end of it. We'll talk again. Joel Burgess, thank you so much.
Always happy to be here.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart am long to go. There's where I labored so hard for old massa, day after day in a field of yellow corn. No place on earth do I love more sincerely than old Virginia, the state where I was born. Carry me back to old Virginia.
Good day. We are coming on the air with breaking news. The governor of Virginia, who was embroiled in controversy over a racist 1984 yearbook photo, is about to make a statement. Governor Ralph Northam, a Democrat elected in 2017, facing intense political pressure to resign after a photo surfaced that appeared on his page in a 1984 medical school yearbook. It shows one person in blackface, another in a KKK costume. After apologizing for appearing in the photo last night, the governor told prominent Democrats this morning he now believes he is not in the picture. NBC's Jeff Bennett is at the Executive Mansion in Richmond. Jeff?
Jose, good afternoon. Here's what we know based on our reporting. We expect Governor Northam to walk out here in just a minute's time and make the case to the American public that he is not resigning because he believes he's not one of the two people featured in that racist photo from his 1984 medical school yearbook. So this, of course, would be a complete reversal as to what he said yesterday, both in the written statement and the statement that was released on his Twitter account. So the governor is going to have to make the case for why he believes that he should stay in office if he, in fact, says he will not resign, and I believe he's walking out now.
Let's go to him now.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you all for being here. I'm pleased to be joined by my wife, Pam. Pam, thank you for being here as well. There has been much public discussion about racist and offensive materials that appear on my page of the 1984 Eastern Virginia Medical School yearbook. And I believe it is important for Virginians to hear directly from me and for me to answer as many questions as are necessary about these circumstances. With that in mind, I would like to read a statement about these events, and then I will be glad to take your questions. Yesterday, I took responsibility for content that appeared on my page in the Eastern Virginia Medical School yearbook that was clearly racist and offensive. I am not and will not excuse the content of the photo. It was offensive, racist, and despicable. When my staff showed me the photo in question yesterday, I was seeing it for the first time. I did not purchase the EVMS yearbook, and I was unaware of what was on my page. When I was confronted with the images yesterday, I was appalled that they appeared on my page, but I believe then and now that I am not either of the people in that photo. I stand by my statement of apology to the many Virginians who were hurt by seeing this content on a yearbook page that belongs to me. It is disgusting. It is offensive. It is racist. And it was my responsibility to recognize and prevent it from being published in the first place. I recognize that many people will find this difficult to believe. The photo appears with others I submitted on a page with my name on it. Even in my own statement yesterday, I conceded that, based on the evidence presented to me at the time, the most likely explanation that it was indeed me in the photo. In the hours since I made my statement yesterday, I reflected with my family and classmates from the time and affirmed my conclusion that I am not the person in that photo. While I did not appear in this photo, I am not surprised by its appearance in the EVMS yearbook. In the place and time where I grew up, many actions that we rightfully recognize as abhorrent today were commonplace. My belief that I did not wear that costume or attend that party stems in part from my clear memory of other mistakes I made in the same period of my life. That same year, I did participate in a dance contest in San Antonio, in which I darkened my face as part of a Michael Jackson costume. I look back now and regret that I did not understand the harmful legacy of an action like that. It is because my memory of that episode is so vivid that I truly do not believe I am in the picture in my yearbook. You remember these things. As I began my career and met my wife, Pam, I also began to develop a stronger understanding of this country's history and the harm that certain actions and attitudes cause. That does not excuse my behaviors up to that point, but it did offer me an opportunity to change and to grow, and I took it. I pursued my career as a soldier, a physician, and as a public servant because I wanted to help people. The experiences I had in each of those chapters and the people I met along the way helped me form a set of values that define the person I am now and the way I aspire to lead this Commonwealth as your governor. In some ways, my personal history mirrors that of this Commonwealth. There are actions and behaviors in my past that were hurtful. But, like Virginia, I have also made significant progress in how I approach these issues. I am far from perfect, and I can always strive to do more. But I have devoted my entire life, my career in the Army, as a pediatrician, and in public service, to making life better for all people, no matter who they are. Today, I am not ready to ask Virginians to grant me their forgiveness for my past actions. I also do not fully expect that they will immediately believe my account of these events. Right now, I am simply asking for the opportunity to demonstrate, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that the person I was is not the man I am today. I am asking for the opportunity to earn your forgiveness. If I were to listen to the voices calling on me to resign my office today, I could spare myself from the difficult path that lies ahead. I could avoid an honest conversation about harmful actions from my past. I cannot in good conscience choose the path that would be easier for me in an effort to duck my responsibility to reconcile. I took an oath to uphold this office and serve the people of this Commonwealth to the best of my ability. As long as I believe I can effectively fulfill that task, I intend to continue doing the business of Virginia. I believe this moment can be the first small step to open a discussion about these difficult issues and how they contribute to the greater racism and discrimination that defines so much of our history. This very house stands as a monument to the dark and complicated history of this Commonwealth. These walls are adorned with portraits of men and women who owned slaves, actively oppressed people of color, as well as men and women who stood tall and advanced the causes of equality and racial justice in the Commonwealth and this country. In that discussion, it will not be my role to speak to Virginians about these issues. My responsibility is to listen, to learn, and to continue to grow as a man and as a leader. I am ready for an honest conversation about racial injustice and the need for real reconciliation, real justice, and real equality. I believe the agenda this administration is pursuing clearly demonstrates the progress both I and our Commonwealth have made since the darkest chapters of our history. I promise to fight for a Virginia that works better for all people, and our commitment to economic justice, access to health care, criminal justice reform, educational equity, and a clean environment reflect those priorities. As this conversation moves forward, I want to hear from Virginians from every walk of life about how we can fight even harder to build the Virginia that they deserve. Before I take questions, I want to take this opportunity to apologize to the many people who have been hurt by this episode and mistakes that I have made in the past. I am ready to earn your forgiveness, and I am ready to begin today. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions. Yes, sir.
Be crystal clear. You're saying that you had no idea this racist photo existed before it surfaced less than 24 hours ago.
The photo in the EVMS yearbook?
Yes.
That's correct. I was in the United States Army while I was in medical school. I knew where I was going upon graduation from medical school. I was doing rotations out of the state. I had nothing to do with the preparation of the yearbook, nor did I buy one. And so this was the first time, yesterday evening was the first time I saw this photo. It was shocking, and it was horrific.
How do you account for one of your nicknames that's listed in the VMI yearbook in 1981, Coon Man? What's your explanation for that?
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold up. Stop the motherfucking record.
Right.
I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
How do you account for one of your nicknames that's listed in the VMI yearbook in 1981, Coon Man? What's your explanation for that?
My main nickname in high school and in college was Goose, because when my voice was changing, I would change an octave. There were two individuals, as best I can recollect, at VMI. They were a year ahead of me that called me Coon Man. I don't know their motives or intent. I know who they are. But that was the extent of that, and it ended up in the yearbook, and I regret that.
Before you spoke, you had almost the entire Democratic establishment calling for your resignation, saying that it's Justin Fairfax who deserves to stand where you're standing right now. What's your response to that?
You know, I think we have done a great job over the last year. We've worked on a lot of the challenges that I just outlined. This has hurt a lot of people. It's hurt a lot of people in our party. I suspect it's hurt people in the opposing party, and it's hurt Virginians. And I want to assure everybody, number one, that that is not my picture. That is not my person on that picture in the yearbook. We will continue to lead. We will continue to talk about the issues that are important. But we also will have a conversation as we move forward about trust. And I have been a man of honor. As you know, I was the president of the Honor Court at VMI. I ask my colleagues, I ask Virginians to accept my word, to realize that I have made mistakes in my past, to offer forgiveness, and then let's all as a Commonwealth move forward.
Last question, sir.
Well, there you heard it, Governor Ralph Northam of Virginia saying he is clearly not planning to resign after saying that he does not believe he is the person in that picture, the yearbook, his med school yearbook in 1984. Also talked about the fact that he did don blackface going to a party once while he was in med school.
Michael Jackson, indeed. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, February 2nd, 2019. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, counter-racist perspectives. The number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Wow, incredible. The timing of the cows throughout our 10-year history has been remarkable. All I can say, Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, suspected race soldier, don't you resign. Don't step down. Do not, as they say, bow to the pressure. Stay in office. I want the Coon Man in the governor's house as long as possible. Governor Ralph Coon Man Northam. That, what do they say? Teachable moment? Anytime someone emailed me this week talking about a victim of racism, and said, boy, that is a coon right there. Anytime you feel the urge to use the word coon, anytime you hear a non-white person, a black person, using the word coon in any way, shape, form, you should be thinking, now, where did they get that concept from, coon? Where did we learn this from to describe, to use this term to talk about someone classified as black? Where did we get that from? The Coon Man. We got that from Governor. That's where we got that from. Calling other black people coons. Got it. I am going to not do that. Doesn't mean that I love this black person. That doesn't mean that I agree with them. But I am not going to continue the brain trashing of Governor Coon Man Northam. I am never going to use the word coon again. Thank you, Coon Man. That is the teachable moment, as they say. Think about, where did we get this word from? The same way with nigger. When I heard that today, that was from today. That was from like hours ago, February 2nd. It's not Groundhog Day. It is Coon Day. February 2nd, from now on, for me, Coon Day. I will remember this. I wish they had asked, give me another follow-up question. So your nickname was Coon Man, to the point that it got in the school yearbook, medical school yearbook, no less. Why were you known as the Coon Man? Would it break it down for me? Those of us who've never heard the term coon before, right? They broke down the brown bag test before. They assumed some of us were ignorant about that. I'm ignorant about the coon. Tell me why they called you the Coon Man, Governor Northam. And then stay in office. Don't leave. Stay there as long as possible. Long live Governor Coon Man, Ralph Northam. Woo! And the Cows Yoga Retreat, he did that press conference in Richmond, Virginia. Cows 10-year anniversary yoga retreat is in Virginia. Gus T, born in Virginia. Airport I think I'm going to have to fly into is Richmond. I thought the highlight, I was flying into Richmond, I was going to get the opportunity to get a KFC Cheetos chicken sandwich. I thought that was going to be the highlight of the trip. They only offer KFC Cheetos chicken sandwiches in limited locations. Georgia, Richmond, I think Norfolk might be the other spot, but it's very limited location, suspiciously with a high population of Negros in the areas where you can get the KFC chicken Cheetos sandwich. But Richmond, Virginia is one of those locations, and I can hop off the plane and get myself a snack. But now, where is the governor set up? The Coon Man. Let me holler at the Coon Man for a few seconds. That would be the highlight of a visit to the great state of VA, the Commonwealth. Wow. Oh, I cannot wait to talk about it. That counter-racism training right there, right there. All of these problems that black people encounter, state of Virginia, they have such a long list of problems with black people. They were just talking about black people not even being able to vote. Not that they were lazy and didn't want to go vote, that they were too lazy and that's why not even being able to vote, like things being done deliberately to make it difficult for black people, especially to vote. You got all these problems. You had all that mayhem, even a white woman being killed in Charlottesville, Virginia. Why do these? Oh, the governor is Coon Man. Got it. Teachable moment right there. If I'm a parent in the state of Virginia, we are going to learn all about state government. Now, what powers does the Coon Man have? Why do we have these problems in all areas of people activity with black people? The Coon Man. The other question, so if this is not you in the photograph, who are these folks in the photograph? And who are the people who called you Coon Man? Because he said he knew who they were. He didn't identify them. Who are they? And remember, these are people who were in med school. These could end up being your gynecologist, your pediatrician, director of the medical board. Who knows? Like, really powerful race soldiers. Who are these folks? Have they been, you know, and again, why do we have all of these problems? Medical apartheid. Harriet Washington is the person to talk to. These are the folks who are in med school. Medical apartheid, top 5 book list for Gus T. Renegade. Get Harriet Washington and ask her a few questions. Now, what does this have to say about your work? These are the med students posing in KKK regalia. And, oh, well, wait a minute. I wasn't in KKK regalia, but I did don shoe polish to dress like Michael Jackson. And I didn't even get that part. They have a clip. You got to get this. This is racism 101. They have a clip of Coon Man Governor Northam explaining about the Michael Jackson segment. He said, I put on shoe polish. And he said, I only put on a little bit of it. He said, I don't know if you know this or not, but that stuff is hard to get off. I mean, wow. It's difficult. I only put a little bit on to do my Michael Jackson. We do not understand what it means to be white. Study the Coon Man. You get the audio where he talks about his Michael Jackson performance and the amount of shoe polish that he put on, and the black friend who told him that this was wrong, and he learned so much. What does it mean to be white, and how do they practice racism, white supremacy? The Coon Man, extraordinary lesson in what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. And again, put that in context, medical apartheid. These are not toothless whites, as they say. These are not, you know, with the hillbilly whites. These are not uneducated whites. Far from it, as far from it as you could possibly get. And this is not ancient history. I think several of the reports that I saw today, wow, this is the 1980s. Wow. You would think this happened, you know, in the 60s. Or I heard several reports that were saying, wow, this is, you know, kind of recent. Yeah, very. System of racism, white supremacy. What does it mean to be white? Again, medical apartheid. If you've not read it, now that you know this, read Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington. Brilliant, brilliant. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The Coon Man. I mentioned the Cows Yoga Retreat, February 21 to February 24 in Druryville, Virginia, which is approximately 60 miles south of Richmond. We will be there 4 days, 3 nights, maximum of 12 people. There are about 5 spots remaining. If you are interested, if you would like details, email untiljustice@gmail.com. Untiljustice@gmail.com. Again, max of 12 spots. We have about 5 remaining. If you are interested in participating, just gave out the information for how people can sign up if they are serious and want to do this retreat. Yoga, plant-based eating for the 4 days, 3 nights that we are there. The yoga is mandatory, doing some counter-racist workshops as well while we're there. I cannot imagine not having anything to say, being in the state of Virginia and having nothing to say about Coon Man Northam while we are in the state. So certainly I will have, you know, something to say on that. But looking forward to it. Few spots remaining. If you need information, untiljustice@gmail.com. I can send out all of the details. And if you have additional questions, let me know. Looking forward to having a constructive opportunity to practice counter racism with other victims of racism. And the yoga, that's part of counter racism, but the yoga as well. Excited about doing yoga exclusively with black people. Should be lots of fun. Self-care is extremely important. Let's see. That's it. Few things before we get to the folks who called in. The interview, they were talking about the book Genesis that dealt with what they call colorism, symptoms of the system of racism, white supremacy in terms of the name calling and the way that black people talk about and treat the black people. Speaking of Coon, I found it repulsive hearing a white man, I believe that was with NPR, doing an interview about colorism with a black author, victim of racism, as though he's ignorant or she is teaching him about these concepts. It just, you know, and him being, oh, and you name dropped so many artists and authors and that sort of thing. I found it repulsive. It had the same vibration. I think we've had other interviews where people have talked about when whites have interviewed victims of white terrorism, like some of the victims of Dylan Storm Roof. That's what it reminded me of. Continuing. the segment, Gordon Parks. Wow. Extraordinary work. He devoted a lot of his immense time, energy, skill to countering racism, white supremacy with his photography, his writings, his film. Well, I wasn't. Shaft, I guess, is something else. But anyway, in that segment where they were talking to Mr. Parks and he said that prejudice or discrimination, that you can make it work for you, and saying that, you know, it made him work harder to do all the things that he wanted to do, and people saying that he couldn't do it and that sort of thing. I've heard that logic before, and I think it's very dangerous. And I don't even think it's logical. I don't think it's logical. I shouldn't even have used that term. I've heard that way of thinking before, and I do not think it is logical, reasonable at all. And I've said it before, applying it to Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, applying it to Gordon Parks, applying it to Serena Williams, applying it to Frederick Douglass, applying it to myself, applying it to anyone, Gabrielle Douglas. I do not think that if they were no longer subject to racism, white supremacy, I think all of their talent and skill would be extraordinarily higher. Everything that they're doing now, they would be able to do astronomically more if they were not, if Serena Williams was not being drug tested and harassed by whites on a regular basis. Yes, I think she would be doing way more in her career, in life. Every single non-white person victim of white supremacy has been restrained. And in fact, I think that very logic or lack of logic is addressed in medical apartheid, because people will say that slavery made black people stronger, and it most certainly did not. I know that that is addressed in Dying While Black with Vernelia Randall, where she says explicitly that that is not true. Any sort of abuse like that is going to make you sicker, weaker. It does not in any way, shape, form make you stronger. Being able to take punishment is not a sign of strength, in my opinion. Next, they mentioned the other books that were mentioned in Genesis, Bluest Eye, Malcolm X. We read those on the Cows Book Club over our tenure. Next, in the segment about Bennett College and perhaps them maybe having to close down, not being financially stable. That is the system of racism, white supremacy. They keep all non-white people, particularly black people, individually and collectively, insecure financially. I think they have that infamous segment from the film Falling Down, came out in the 90s, where the black male, he's protesting outside the bank. He says, I am not economically viable. That's what he's protesting. Not economically viable. They wouldn't give. And then the enforcement officials promptly take him to greater confinement. But yeah, that's what happens to black people. Again, Coon Man, not by accident that all of this happens. So in that segment where they were talking about Bennett College, and they were saying that some black people, they said, were not happy that they decided to accept to accept funds from Popeyes, because I guess the leader or the owner had just said nigger or made some other racist comments, and they didn't think it was appropriate to accept funds from them. System of racism, white supremacy, all of us are getting our funds directly or indirectly from racists. Doesn't matter even if you're getting it from other non-white people. If there is a system of white supremacy, where are we all getting our resources from? That's what racism, white supremacy means. They dominate all areas of people activity. So I do not see, I don't see a logical problem or reason why they should not take the funds. If these are resources that they need and a white person is offering them, you could take it. It doesn't mean that you know, now that they are no longer racist suspects or anything like that. There are certainly problems even with, you know, promoting that sort of unhealthy food, but I certainly would not chastise. I don't even think that that's correct. VGQ, if they decide that that's the best course for them to take at this time, victims guaranteed qualified. And just to add on, I don't see anything incorrect about that at all. And I do not think that they should be chastised or criticized for that. That's, if anything, racists should be criticized for having that college and us in that position to begin with. And then folks can, you know, say whatever they want to about Popeyes. Next. If anybody, or before I get to that, one more. The segment where they were talking about the suspected race soldier in Detroit, it was a black female. He had his dash cam on her, and he was given an announcement, kind of his little commentary as she was walking. And saying walk of shame and all these other racist remarks about this black female. In that recording, he said, "Bye, Felicia." And I've heard that so many times. Immediately, I remembered Chantel. She's participated on the program many times over the years. She talked about being at work and a white male. She was having a conversation with a group of employees, a constructive conversation with a group of employees. They're talking about workplace related, you know, things. There is a white male who is not in this conversation at all. He's sitting in earshot, as they say. He starts being disruptive and it's just like making noise, saying nonsense, making sounds, just trying to practice racism and distract them. So eventually he just says, "Bye, Felicia." And he says it a few times. And this was about the same time period that Straight Outta Compton had come out. And I think there's a scene where that is said there. That go. This is all alluding to Friday, the infamous film from the 90s with a lot of racist stereotypes and what have you. But this line is in that film. And this enforcement official, he said that by Felicia in the recording. And Chantel, she had the segment where the white guy said that on her job. I've heard this repeatedly, whites using that as a racist slur. I think it's important, one, just seeing the patterns in terms of how whites practice racism, what it means to be white. I also think it's important. I don't think we realize whites enjoy those types of films. When I talked about The Hate U Give and I listed like Empire, Precious, Roots, The Help. You could just go on and on and on. Porgy and Bess. White people love these type of films. Friday, I don't know if we are aware of how much racist they really love this sort of content. I think some of us, we might think that this is just, you know, what they call black entertainment. Whites, they really enjoy. The Coon Man, I am sure he has seen Friday. I would take the wager on that anytime. They love these type of films. I knew this, in fact, before I even began really studying racism, white supremacy, and what it means to be white. I remember people that I went to college with, this was like years after Friday had come. It was already like a what they call a cult classic. And so people had already seen it a billion times. I remember people I went to college with, whites, all white people, in fact, they would sit out in the suite area. And when it would be like 10 or more, a group of them, pretty big group. They knew every line of the film, like in sync, like they could do all the parts of the film. So it does not surprise me now reflecting on that. It doesn't surprise me at all that that has become a common racist slur, like "by Felicia," "coon," all, exact same thing. That's just, you know, evolving racism, white supremacy. They just add to the culture of how they practice racism, and it's all the same thing, the anti-blackness degrading black people. With that, that is a metaphor, the "by Felicia" thing, for this broadcast. If we could not use metaphors, this is the one broadcast where I make that explicit request. If we're supposed to be mindful about words, words are very important. Racists, they use metaphors deliberately to practice deception and to practice white supremacy racism. Now, again, I get to go back. It is Coon Day, not Groundhog Day. Coon Man, Governor Northam. Now, he said in his press conference today, where he said he didn't recall dressing up as a Klansman or in darkface as a Negro, he said, beyond a shadow of a doubt, dark history and darkest chapter. Anybody who has their word guide, if you could check to see if shadow of a doubt is in Mr. Fuller's word guide, producejustice.com. If you need Mr. Fuller's word guide or code book, producejustice.com. But if you have access, is shadow of a doubt in the word guide? Much obliged. But those metaphors right there in a press conference where the coon man says, hey, I am not a racist and I'm not stepping down. And you shouldn't. But for this broadcast, if we could not use metaphors frequently, we end up victims of racism. When I say we end up using those same metaphors. Darkest day, darkest chapter, bright child. And these metaphors reinforce the system of racism, white supremacy. Often we are still learning, myself included, and we don't have logic sometimes to articulate our views, and we will incorporate a metaphor or comparison analogy in place of logic. Frequently, that just adds to confusion. If we could be explicit, direct about what we want to say, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about that. Much obliged. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I did mention the yoga retreat. One thing I did want to mention, I have not been as excessive with the yoga racism stories. I do have one for this week. I had mentioned previously, white woman at the yoga studio was not responsive. She ignored me for a month when I was trying to ask about the number of classes and if I had qualified for the reward that they offer after you take a certain number of classes. She deliberately, willfully ignored me, where she acknowledged that she got the email and did not respond. And this went on for a month. So I talked about all of this before. This went on for like a month. So I got compensated for that. And I said then it seemed because this white woman, I'd had repeated problems with her where she had made comments where it was like a white person who had difficulty with a black person doing something constructive. And it's like, oh, I don't want to compliment them, but it's like, I gotta pretend that I gotta say something nice about this. Like, oh, I can't. Oh. Just every time it had been that sort of interaction with her, a pattern of that sort of behavior. That's the same type of thing. That's why I think she was ignoring me about the reward that I had qualified for. In fact, I overqualified for this reward. Anyway, so the next milestone at this yoga studio that they have is for when you take 500 yoga classes. I took my 500th yoga class sometime at the end of last week. So I contacted and found out that the white woman, suspected race soldier, who ignored me and didn't want to acknowledge when I took my 300th yoga class, she now is not even doing this project anymore. They moved her and gave this to someone else to do the rewards when people take their classes. So this got moved to a totally different person. And I just said, wow, I can only conclude that this could be racism, white supremacy directly, that this white woman was so bothered by a black person, a black male performing. And I think it is also important because she called attention to this. Out of all of her rudeness and deliberate white supremacy, she said, Gus T, fastest person at their studio to take 100 classes, now the fastest person to take 100 classes, 300 classes, 500 classes at their studio. Apparently, it infuriated her so that she is no longer doing this program. That's my theory. It could be an error, but I don't. There's a lot of evidence that would suggest that that absolutely could be what took place. Anyway, with that, the number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Did anybody see the Coon Man, Governor Northam? Did you all see the part of the press conference where he talked about how much shoe polish he put on when he was doing his Michael Jackson performance? Did anybody see that? I mean, I wish you can't play everything, but wow. If you saw that, I would love just for verification that that does exist. It is worth looking for it on YouTube or wherever if you can track it down to hear the Coon Man explaining shoe polish application for blackface performance. If you have commentary, star 61. And first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hey, what's going on, Gus? Hope everything is going fine on your side of the world. First, let me begin to say that I totally agree with you. And the word coon will be replaced simply if I disagree with a victim of maybe incorrect behavior, or if you want to call it sellout behavior. But as Nellie Fuller say, we all participate in this system, so we are all sellouts. I would just basically replace coon with anti-blackness. So I make that pledge today. I really do believe that it's not constructive. And like you, I've also took those names that you don't want to hear, those black names that you don't want to hear anymore. I totally don't want to hear them no more. Neither you know the names. You read the list down, if I'm not mistaken, last show, you know, Jesse Jackson, Obama, Sharpton. Me too. I do agree. I don't want this governor to step down. Just as I'm requesting 4 more years of Donald Trump. I do not want these non-white candidates, whether it's Cory Booker or whether it's Kamala Harris, I do not want them in office and to basically be blamed by the actions of white racists. Because, I mean, once they get in office, then, you know, they will take the brunt of insults, whether it's, anti-black slurs or anything that's destructive that goes on in black society, they will take the blame. But however, white man, white woman is always behind the scenes causing mayhem. So Donald Trump, 4 more years. I know you don't want to talk about TV shows. So I won't even name drop the TV show, and I won't even name drop the network. But there was a show with a black woman went back in time and fell in love with a slave master.
Can I pause there? Because I've already said I'm never watching another slave film. So this is something that I have like zero. It's a television program. Right. So that is a double whammy.
I'll move on. But that was just interesting. But I was using that to basically say how the cows has basically made me so sensitive to anti-black programming and propaganda, anti-blackness coming from black people. It's like, I pick up on it. Metaphors. As I was talking to other victims, and it had nothing to do with racism, but making false comparisons of things that shouldn't go with each other. And I see how it adds to the confusion. But again, I really just only called to make commentary on that governor. I too want the Coon Man to stay in office, and I also want our beloved president to get 4 more years. And I'll add something later.
Yes, sir. Thank you for your commentary. I do not think you have any worries or concern at all. I think Donald Trump will easily be reelected in 2020. I think I've said that before, but I would increase the wager each day. I'm ever more certain, easy reelection. Donald Trump, line them all up. Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Bernie Sanders, if he wants to try again, Hillary Clinton, if she wants to try again, line them all up. Donald Trump, easy in 2020. That's not even a concern. I did the pledge. Thank you. I think that's so important. Mr. Fuller has talked about no name calling. Dr. Welsing has talked about no name calling. Minister Malcolm X, his book was mentioned. He apologized for the name calling that he did. It is not constructive. It does not help solving any problems. And most importantly, where did we get these names that were, where did we get that to call a black person a coon? Why am I calling you a coon? Why is that so popular? Other folks that we've not heard from, if you have commentary.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. There were good clips. I appreciate the information about Mr. Parks. It's always important to highlight constructive black work. The story about the crayons, of course, they have those stories from time to time. And I just remember being in school and using a lot of the brown crayons. So I don't know. I guess I might have been different, but no one ever asked me about using a white crayon because I never seen a white person. I never thought about it. I don't remember doing that. I personally did see the clip on CNN with the governor. He was showing how to apply it, like he was doing a makeup video. He was like, yeah, you can apply it like this. So that is, I don't know if it's on YouTube, but it did happen. I saw the clip on CNN that he was showing, you know, how that works, which, you know, I never knew about that because I don't know. I can't say I'm going to stop using the word coon. I've never used it to describe black people, but maybe these are the white people who are holding the door and stuff like that. So that would be cool with me and my mom. So maybe this is a cool man because he's nice to us, or a cool woman. So I don't know. And, he said once he got married, I would want to know first what his wife taught him about racism that opened his eyes, because as we talk about a lot on the show, you know, and he read with the book that we're reading and the book club, that white women are very instrumental in promoting racism. So I would want to know that. And I did think a lot of things that you were thinking before you said about medical apartheid. And I was thinking, you know, no one's talking about the school, how the school allowed this to be published and things like that. Again, even to go back to when they talk about Russia and how they infiltrated black America, you know, with all these things, like they were totally made up, like Darren Wilson came from Russia to kill Mike Brown, or Chris Zimmerman came from Russia and infiltrated Ron Martin, or Daniel Holdsclaw came from Russia. I mean, although all of those people, Russian transplants as well, they never want to deal with the real problem, just things on the surface. And last but not least, because I can't really think of anything else right now, because of the state of confusion we are in, I am definitely confused because I thought Virginia was for lovers. I guess I was wrong. Thank you.
That's what they say. That's what they say. I'm trying to see if we can get that on the cow's T-shirt for the yoga anniversary, if we get everything done correctly. But that is what they say when you enter the state. Virginia is for lovers. I would like that replaced instead of the heart. I would like that replaced with a picture of what was on the Coon Man's yearbook page with the Klansmen and the white person in blackface. I think that would be more appropriate. And then the song that I played, Carry Me Back to Old Virginia, which used to be the state song. I said they should have just kept it. This, I think it's the state song emeritus now, but they should have just kept it the same. That would have, everything would have been appropriate and correct. Others.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am.
Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
I remember what I wanted to say about the Super Bowl, not that, or watching and things like that. But Colin Kaepernick seemed to be an issue last year, but that wasn't a problem. I'm wondering, like, it's because it's in Atlanta, which is seen as a quote-unquote black city, that this is now more of a problem than ever, trying to make a quote-unquote black city look bad in terms of Super Bowl activity. I just thought about that recently because he was a quote-unquote problem last year as well, and I don't remember all this backlash. I think Justin Timberlake or whatever did it. It was great. And yay, Super Bowl. So I don't know if that's something that's coming to play as well with all this Super Bowl backlash and things like that. Thank you.
That's an important point as well, I think, because, yeah, I don't remember this from last year either. Racists can be very shrewd about timing of things, when things are reportedly now this is an outrage. Could have been something that's been happening for a long time, but now people are upset about it. They're very good about when they can make you pay attention to things. Very good. Others who've dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Let's see. Let's get Draftomania first, and then we'll get the mail caller.
Okay, thank you, Gus. Hi, Gus and the guests. I just wanted to make a couple comments regarding the implants. It was pretty scary to me with the whole implant thing, from how they have these old the prophecies in the Bible and things like that. When he was talking about the implants, I was wondering, I have a question. I was wondering if the implants could be, they were saying that the implants that they were going to be installing into humans, I was wondering if they could be hacked and hacked. Well, the implants can be hacked. So if someone hacks into these chips, will they have the ability to affect the person's bodily functions or cause death? Like with the whole hacking of the implants that they're putting in people's bodies, that would be one of the questions that I would like to ask the makers of these implants. And in regards to the CRISPR editing, I think it's a great job that the doctor is doing in regards to eliminating blindness and possible other diseases. But however, of course, due to you know, white supremacy, racism, you know, this CRISPR can always be used to basically help to, being that their numbers are down to 9%, they can, you know, it could be utilized for the super race, like they was talking about Adolf Hitler and the things that Hitler was planning on doing. I think that they will definitely be used in this gene editing to save their populations. In regards to the reporter that discussed the colorism with the non-white black woman, I found it repulsive also, Gus, when he said that. I found it repulsive when he said that black people were practicing racism on one another because we were using the racial racist programming to define our worth regarding saying that we were basically taught to think of ourselves as better because of our lighter skin. That's criteria. That was superimposed on us through, you know, white supremacy, racism. So how is it that we're being racist by us, you know, just using the programming that we were taught all throughout, you know, all throughout slavery and living in this system? So I just found that to be quite annoying. And I agree with you, Gus, when we discuss these matters with suspects, like they are ignorant And it is repulsive. I left a book club recently due to the narrator of the book club, which is a non-white black woman. You know, there were a lot of suspects that was showing up, and you know, she had like a she would discuss like her childhood and different events about just like, I guess, war stories and different things as being a victim what we go through as a result of the system. And I just found it to be quite, I found it to be a little embarrassing and degrading for her to discuss, well, you know, I got up out of that environment because if I didn't leave that environment, I might end up being with five babies. And I just found it to be, it was just a little bit too much for me. So I just made a decision not to go back. I do understand that she's a victim, but, like, I just can't do that, you know, discussing the problems that, like, because like you said, they're going to do is just sit back and, you know, laugh and call you names or whatever. I just didn't find it to be constructive. And I found it to be quite embarrassing. I felt embarrassed for her saying that. So, and I was also, I was called a coon on Facebook once by a suspect, you know, and some of the, I think I had, I posted something and one of the, you know, little racist trolls got on my post and they called me a coon. It was a white person too. They called me a coon. So I definitely agree with you. When we're using these racist verbiages, we have to remember where did these terms originate from. So I found it to be pretty funny because when she said that, I had never thought of being called a coon by a white person. I had always only heard that terminology used by us on each other. So, you know, that brings it into perspective when you hear the origins and like when you, when you hear that, you know, a white guy, man, that who is a governor and or whatever he is, using, being called a coon man. So, you know, that's all I had to share. And thank you.
Governor of the state of Virginia, very important, or at least I think important. Dr. Wellesley, she would say the system of racism, white supremacy, local, national, global. Governor of the state of Virginia. If you live, we have listeners who live in the state of Virginia, and the COWS yoga retreat participants, including Gus T, will be in the state of Virginia. So it is very relevant to me that the governor is Coon Man Northam. The black male who yielded, thank you kindly. Did you have commentary, sir?
I did. This is Jay in St. Louis. I wanted to speak about at least four things. First, I wanted to start with Miss Alicia Williams. I actually purchased that text after I heard that segment, so I will be reporting back and letting you know whether or not she captures the origin of colorism properly, what I'll characterize it as I see fit, once me and my black daughters are done reading it. So I will be letting you know about that. I also wanted to speak about Mr. Parks, who is someone I have read about extensively. I think he is a great example of black genius, but I also think he is an example of when black genius is not supported by a social structure that can protect and sustain it. Mr. Parks had some run-ins with the FBI later on in his life and unfortunately willingly participated in counter-insurgence programs with the FBI to undermine the very subjects of his photographs in many cases. I also wanted to talk about the implantation of some kind of chips in human beings. Did I say that properly? It was like microchips or something, right?
Correct.
Yeah, I think that was interesting that the ethicist who was talking about how new technology is not to be trusted because it has been abused so much. And I feel the same way about whites. I think the reasoning he deployed was logical, but any time that's applied to like cases, it's denied when whites are the subject at hand. I also wanted to say, to add some more context to Coon Man, the governor of Virginia, there is another video that was released just 5 hours ago of a debate when Coon Man was running for lieutenant governor. He was running against a black male. The black male reached to shake his hand at the end of the debate twice on camera for about 5 seconds straight. His hand was out there. He refused to shake his hand. So I think that just adds even more context to this. I think the institution in which this took place, it says a lot about the collective responsibility for white supremacy that the institution itself has. And I also think it's very illuminating that, or was that a metaphor, illuminating?
I don't think so, no.
Okay, I just want to check myself. Okay, just want to make sure I'm being clear. So I think it was very illuminating that that institution, I doubt that that institution is hurting for funds or scrambling for money or at the brink of closure while this black institution has to do what they can to stay open. And then lastly, I wanted to speak about the different ways that a so-called black entertainment is really just white entertainment. You spoke about how a lot of entertainment genres and movies are actually enjoyed by whites. And I personally, I have been terrorized by whites. They love, I think I've spoken about this before, but I've been terrorized into consuming different television programs and hearing stand-up comedy routines by so-called black comedians. The crowd is 99.5% white. They love the so-called black entertainment, and for a lot of non-white black people, it is really an act of terrorism on us because we are so easily seduced into thinking that if we see a black person, then we must be the target audience. And that is something I think we're going to have to resist going forward. Just because there's a black person on the screen does not mean this was written for, written by, and has any kind of good intent for black people. So yeah, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for letting me speak.
Yes, sir. Much obliged, Jay in St. Louis. Victims of racism, whites can compromise any victim of racism, white supremacy. That is definitely something to be mindful of in the system, and why it's very important to have a code, a united, independent code, as Mr. Fuller suggests, producejustice.com. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red.
May I be heard?
Let's get Red in Nevada first.
Thank you for allowing me to share. Thank you for the other caller for yielding. I'll try to be really quick because I have like about six things. The first thing about the clip is also about that book, Genesis. I took note of the, I think it was a white reporter or interviewer saying, there's not that much backlash from pointing out racism outside of your own race, but when it is inside of your own race, there's backlash, which that, you know, that wasn't addressed at all. That wasn't refuted. Rather, it wasn't refuted at all, which, you know, that doesn't make sense. You do get, quote unquote, backlash for pointing out racism. You know, you can just throw in the name Colin Kaepernick, you know, if you, you know, need an example. Then, speaking about the whole bi Felicia thing, I didn't realize, and this is like workplace racism. I just usually don't call in because there's so much nonsense that goes on and racist nonsense, basically. But there are these two white men who sit close to where I sit in at the plantation, and I had heard them say Big Booty Judy before and was referencing somebody, and I didn't think anything of it, you know, just kind of made a mental note and, you know, continued whatever the task I had going on. But then I realized there was these other black females who, you know, always friendly to them or whatever. The white men, they were having a conversation and they said it again, something about Big Booty Judy. And I can't remember what it was about, whether it was food or something. And apparently they were talking about one of the black females. And I guess, you know, she just kind of, you know, she just kind of goes along with it because she responded back to when they said it. So I'm just like, you know, that's another thing, you know, not just by Felicia, but even, you know, that they're not ignorant of, you know, the stereotypes or whatever. The next thing was, now this is just about different articles from the Las Vegas Review Journal. So on about a week ago, there was, because they always have gun shows, there was, it's called SHOT, S-H-O-T Show 2019. And the article is about, it says, that's actually the article's name, SHOT 2019, Las Vegas, Nye County, test gun-mounted cameras. And it basically goes into why, like, Nye County, which is actually a county west of Las Vegas, it's closer, it's, like, actually on the Nevada-California border. It's also, interesting enough, one of the 11 counties in Nevada that also has legalized prostitution. So they decided that they wanted to start testing gun-mounted firearms. When you take the firearm out of the holster, it's supposed to start recording in under a second. They feel like it's supposed to be more transparency. The lieutenant of Pahrump, which is where Nye County is located, Nye is N-Y-E, David Brushowitz, he said that body cameras, they're like a godsend, especially involving, there was a recent claims of abuse against penitentiary officers. But they were just kind of talking about that and how wonderful that's supposed to be, having a more close-up view of, you know, victims, I'm assuming, being shot is better for them. And they also kind of discussed the cost of it. Well, as I was doing, you know, just reading the papers more, and there was also something else about Nye County. Apparently, plutonium was secretly shipped to the Nevada National Security Site from the Energy Department. It's about 65 miles west of Las Vegas, also in that same county. They said it was a half a metric ton, and whites didn't get the proper permission from other whites to ship it. So as I was looking more into that, like the whole the Nevada National Security Site and where that is and everything like that, apparently there was an officer-involved fatal shooting. This is just within, you know, a week of Nye County announcing that they were going to, you know, the camera-mounted guns. They don't describe the victim, the name, and of course, the anonymity of the officer who fatally shot the victim. But the victim's name is Nikilo Dwayne Graves. He was 27, I believe. Now, I don't know if maybe by the name, if he was actually a non-white person or not, but they don't have a picture or anything like that. All they did, and of course, there's not that much information. It's just basically, they said that he drove through the main gate. He stopped. He got out of his vehicle. They said that he wasn't complying to their demands, and they shot him. But, you know, but then also within that whole incident, that officer in Nye County didn't have one of those camera-mounted guns. So just going on that, it's kind of interesting, all this unfolded within the past week or so. The last thing is there was another article. It was called Hoping for Change, and it's about medical apartheid. It was actually a cover article on, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday of this week, and it had a black male with his black child, and then they were holding a picture of a black female. Apparently, the black female she had, who was his wife, had sickle cell anemia. She went into the hospital, and within 3 days, she was dead. Monday, she went in on Saturday night. By Sunday night, They thought that everything was fine because people with sickle cell, they're in and out of the hospital. They felt like it was routine. By Monday, she was lethargic. Tuesday, she couldn't hold a conversation. And then Wednesday, they had her in restraints. In the article, he asked why did they have her in restraints, but they didn't give him an explanation, or at least that's basically the article. It didn't explain that, and he had to go to work by the time. So when he went to work, he got a call. Basically, she had went into cardiac arrest. They had found out that she was given an excessive dose of an anti-inflammatory drug. But the hospital, which another thing, big part of the article is that he was awarded $43 million. But, you know, since it's really early on when he got that reward, you never know, because whites, they don't, you know, actually like to comply. He might, you know, have that might get appealed. Thank you for allowing me to share. I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. The female caller who spoke up simultaneously, proceed.
May I be hearing?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus. This is the caller in Colorado. It's been a minute since I've called in. I had to call in for today's broadcast because, yes, I made a horrible decision, and I'm currently going through a divorce with a tragic arrangement. I married a white physician, and to see what's going on in Virginia with the governor, I actually went to grad school in Virginia. It's probably one of my favorite states, just because of my grad school experience. I went to Hampton University, and that university was just a beautiful experience for me. But I am in the process of reading Medical Apartheid by myself. I didn't read it with the Cals, but I am kind of reading along in the archives. And I had to set the book down a number of times because it was just so heavy. And to be married to a physician who I've come to find out is racist has only kind of compounded that feeling. But EVMS is a university that a lot of students out of the HBCU I came out of, Hampton, go to. In fact, I know a number of physicians right now who are black physicians who went to EVMS. So, I mean, it was shocking. I won't say it was shocking, but it was just like, wow, like this, like I know three black female physicians that just graduated from EVMS. So I'm just wondering, you know, what they feel about that. But this white physician who I'm married to, I'm currently divorcing. It was after, you know, we were married, I found out he also, in his medical school, which was in California, 90% white, has a picture of himself in blackface. And so I don't know if it's a rite of passage. I don't know if it's just, you know, like Dr. Wilson says, whenever blacks aren't in certain spaces, whites are always, you know, talking about us, always trying to degrade us. But I just didn't get the connection. You know, we were married for like a year when I found this photo. And I'm just like, why, what was the purpose of this? It was for Halloween. He was trying to be Mike Tyson for Halloween. And out of all the people in the picture, like, you know, and these are all medical students. You know, these are all medical students. It's not like some rinky-dink community college. It's not some, you know, undergrad. You know, these are, I mean, and then it's hard to get into medical school. I've tried twice, you know. And so for these people with these types of ambitions, and like you said, Gus, like these are your OBGYNs, these are your pediatricians, these are people that you trust your life to, and they are racist. And so reading Medical Apartheid, like I said, being married to a physician, going through the stuff that I've gone through in this so-called marriage, I would just encourage the listeners, I mean, if you can at all, if it's at all possible, or if at all up to you, when you do pick your OBGYN, when you do pick your pediatrician, try to pick a person of color. I know that's not always easy, but if you can, I would strongly encourage it. If a black person is an option for a physician, at least go with somebody of color. And that's all I have to say.
Much obliged. That is amazing. Were you able to inquire about when you found the photo? Were you able to ask any questions about the Halloween attire? I mean, the Mike Tyson costume, or no?
I did. Yeah, we definitely talked about it quite a bit.
Oh, do you remember any?
When
go ahead.
Go ahead. I when I first saw it, I was like, okay, maybe he's just ignorant. Maybe he doesn't understand that there's like a huge racial, you know, history to this. And he of course, like acted ignorant. Like he didn't know about minstrel shows and that kind of thing. And I asked him, was this at your undergrad? Because you went to undergrad in Canada. Or was this at your medical school university? And he said this was medical school. So I was like, why are you dressing up in blackface when I know your medical class, there's, you know, not a single black person there. And he's just like, oh, it's just, you know, it was a joke. It was Halloween. I didn't know anything that was offensive about it. Mind you, this man is not dumb. This man knows more about black history than I probably do. Well read in every subject. I mean, just a walking encyclopedia. So when I did start opening, like, you know, telling him about minstrel shows and how they are racist and they're heavily offensive, you know, he's just acting, he's just eating it all up. And it's just, you know, new knowledge to him when I know for a fact it can't be new knowledge. And I can go beyond that, but I'm just, there are other incidents that have happened in the marriage to just to, you know, underscore the fact that these people are not ignorant and their hearts are very antagonistic towards black people.
Much obliged. Hearts antagonistic. That is a metaphor. Other folks who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus and the listeners. Happy Coon Day. Shadow of a doubt. Mr. Fuller suggests do not use this word. Hold on. Do not use this word. Can I be heard from this?
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? Okay. Instead, use the word doubt. It is not necessary to associate the word doubt with the word shadow. A shadow is dark. White supremacists, racists, often deliberately use any word that is generally associated with darkness in a manner that helps to promote thoughts of uncertainty, ugliness, unpleasantness, evil, foreboding, danger, etc. This includes the use of the term enlightened, a term that white supremacists racists indirectly associate with ways and means of thinking against doubtful shadows and or people who are dark in appearance. Doubt is doubt, and a shadow is a shadow. Though a shadow is dark, there is no logical reason to associate the word shadow with the word doubt, or the word doubt with the word dark. Example, to white supremacist racist culture, the expression, I'm in the dark about what happens means I do not know and or I have a doubt. And that's the word on the suggestion on the word shadow of a doubt. Yes, I also hope that Mr. Coon, that was a nickname?
Coon Man.
Coon Man stays as the governor of Virginia for the full term, unless he quits it and does like the racist former governor of the state of Florida, applies for and gets elected as the senator from the state of Virginia. DCF program today had a presentation in front of the parents to let the parents give the parents an assessment of what their sons had been doing and where they had been going on field trips and what they learned from that particular session. Things went off pretty good today in that light. That's it for today. I'll just listen to the. I love the testimony from the last caller. I love the testimony. That's always something to listen to firsthand when a non-white person has that type of experience and basically learns from it and is able to make a decision that is, in my opinion, is constructive. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Happy Coon Day. Others who die, and much obliged for reading Mr. Fuller's word guide. I thought Shadow of Doubt was in the text. Others who dialed in that we've not heard from at all, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guys. Greetings to all the callers as well as the listeners. This is in Yame in Nebraska. I heard a couple of things. In that clip about the brown crayon, the teacher talking about the students who didn't want to use or didn't feel comfortable using much brown in their crayons, it made me think of how you always hear that hatred is taught at an early age, like no one's born hating people. And what they really mean to say is no one's born racist. And it's a way, I feel like that's a way for people to give the racist child more excuses for their acts of racism. But this this story illustrated for me how victimization by racists is also learned at an early age if the children can connect the dots that something in society doesn't like the brown in their skin and make them want to have lighter skin or at least reflected in self-portraits of their artwork early in class, at an early age in class. I didn't hear how old or the age range of these children, but that's what stuck out for me with that story. On the subject of the word coon, I've always felt uncomfortable using it, as I've always known it was something derogatory that so-called white people use to dehumanize us. So I never felt really comfortable using that term, but I did use the term nigger in the past, and I learned if I'm going to use that term, I'm kind of agreeing with them, even if I'm trying to turn it around and, you know, make it like a term of endearment or something. In a way, we're kind of agreeing with them, even if we try to change the meaning of it. So I stopped using that term as well as the term coon. The term that I did pick up was the term familiar as a noun relating to a servant attempting to gain favor with their master. And it comes from the root Latin word of familis, which relates to servants. And that's also where the word family comes from, which means a house of servants or servants of a household. But at the same time, I'm not sure if I'm accurately describing a behavior or if I'm name calling. So I just fell back on that as well. I do use the term cracker in terms of, you know, white people, but I use it like Malcolm X had described, you know, the one who cracks the whip on us. I'm not sure if that's a metaphor or not. And at the same time, I'm not sure if that's name calling as well. So I try to fall back and analyze the terms that I'm using now as I become more codified or as I attempt to counter racism. That was one more thing I just wanted to offer on the subject of these candidates who may attempt to dethrone Donald Trump, which I don't think is going to happen either. Seems like the opposition is, or his opposition is, just throwing whoever they can in the race, and hopefully someone can get the votes. But there's a candidate up. I forgot her name. I think it's Marianne Williamson. Marianne Williamson. I guess she's not a politician, but she's known for being a so-called spiritual guru, working with Oprah Winfrey. And I thought it was interesting because she announced she was running for president as well. This is a white woman. And part of her agenda, I guess, is that she wants to give reparations for black people. The number she threw out was $100 billion, but she said it was to be given to a council to set up different types of programs, and it would be funded about $10 billion a year for 10 years. And I thought that was quite interesting. And that's pretty much all I have to share. Thanks for your time, and I'll mute my line.
Interesting to get a little bit more information on this person, but she's definitely not going to have a serious candidacy if that is a part of her platform at all. Others who dialed in, if we've not heard from you, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard? Can I be heard? Go first. Thank you. Yes, this is Amandi C. I was going to make mention about the white people who talk about white people not existing in a short period of time, or white people going through an extinction process. In particular, the guy, or this particular individual, Guy McPherson. Well, he says that basically we got into this, or that the situation where white people are going, or that there's going to be a extinction of humans, the reason that has happened is racism. I heard him say that racism is the reason that there's going to be this massive extinction in a short period of time. And of course, I'm saying that the massive extinction that he's talking about is white people. But he says that the reason this extinction is about to happen is because of racism, which I would imagine he's speaking about white supremacy. However, there's a paradox. The paradox is that they have to continue this system the way that it's currently running, as in you have to continue racism, white supremacy, in order to make sure that the white people, or that there's not this massive extinction of humans. So they say that the only way that there will not be a massive extinction of humans is that the system, the way things are running right now, all the pollution that is pumped into the air, that's what they're talking about, the aerosols that are pumped into the air, and they're speaking from the ground level, from these industries, that has to continue, as in white supremacy has to continue, so that they can continue to spray the chemtrails over the sky, and that the chemtrails can stay in the sky and be held up by something. So the paradox is, we can't stop white supremacy. We just can't do it. And so, but I think it's interesting and that it would be interesting to have one of these people, white people, are talking about racism is the reason that there might be a massive extinction of people, to have them on the show. And because the ones that I've heard say that, it's more than one, say that racism is the reason that this massive extinction, according to them, is about to take place. I thought that was interesting. The other thing is, in the beginning of this broadcast, when you were speaking, Mr. Gus, there was a lot of segments that were just like chopped out or that were muted. I couldn't hear. When you started speaking about blackface, that there was a segment that I couldn't hear. And then when you, it was a few other times, it might've been three other times or if I had the count right. But yeah, so thank you.
Thank you for alerting me to that. I'll make sure to double check the recording to see if there are any errors with the recording. I'll double check to make sure. You can hear me okay now?
Yes, sir. I suspected that it might have been racist interference because it was at key points when you were making points that even I was really interested to hear what you're about to say. So, yes, I can hear you now, though.
Okay. I'll make sure to double check the recording to make sure there are no problems with the recording at those points when I was speaking at the beginning. Thomas in New York, thank you for your patience, sir.
Good evening, Josh. Good evening to all the callers. And I also, you went out in my feed too, so there was definitely some interference. I suspect white people, as always. I think that the mass extinction that Imhan DC is talking about is white people's plan to exterminate non-white people. They have certain technologies that I don't think they see non-white people as really necessary. Bennett College, founded by a white activist by the name of Albion Torgi or Torgi. A lot of these historical black colleges are named after or founded by white people. Spelman College, named after John D. Rockefeller's wife. And I can't think of too many white people who have been have funded white supremacy more than John D. Rockefeller, even at his death. The Gene Editing, we go from the white supremacist science of eugenics, which means EU good and genics genes, to the Human Genome Project, which is the scientific research project with the goal of determining the sequence of human DNA and also identifying and mapping all the genes within the human genome. And then we go to CRISPR, which, you know, is essentially the science of eliminating bad genes. So I look at all three of those things as one thing. I don't separate them. You'll find the same pattern. And who funded all three programs, what colleges those things are taught in, it's the same thing. The chip, that's a biometric. Gone are the days of driver's license and state IDs and school IDs and social security cards, passports, and other known identification systems. You know, not even your PIN number or your password is necessary anymore because of biometrics, which is fingerprint, palm, brain, and facial recognition. DNA, palm print, hand geometry, iris recognition, retina recognition, and odor and scent recognition. And add on top of that, they have something called behavior metrics. They aren't just collecting our biological characteristics. This is our behavioral characteristics, which in with the new neural processing chips, these two things work together simultaneously. So your behavioral characteristics could be your patterns of human behavior, the way you move, your motions, your gestures, your typing rhythm, your writing style, the way you walk, the way you run, jog, your voice recognition. So this is what they're moving toward. This is coming down the pike very soon. Take me out to old Virginia. Virginia, Maryland, named after the Virgin Mary herself. What I got from the governor was buckets of words, word masters, and white obfuscation. I like the governor from, I think it was New Hampshire better, with Smoothie and D-Money. I thought he was a little bit more stuck to it. But this guy did it. He admitted to it and didn't admit to it. Michael Jackson. I dressed up like Michael Jackson. Then I hear the lady say her husband dressed up in black paint with like Mike Tyson. I guess they could put some shoe polish on and a Bulls jersey and be Michael Jordan. Some light shoe polish and be Scottie Pippen or Steph Curry. You know, it's just the system of white supremacy. This is how they think. As I think it was alluded to earlier, Dr. Welding says that a colleague of hers told her that when black people are not around, white people are continuously and constantly talking bad about black people. So this doesn't surprise me. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, guys.
Indeed. I think that's Governor LePage up in the New England area who was talking about Smoothie and the drug dealers, drug peddlers who were coming up there and getting white women pregnant. The Coon Man, I did find that interesting because at first he did say that it was him, and then he said it wasn't him, but there were other times when he dressed up and engaged in similar behavior, which might as well have just stuck to what you said to begin with. And anyway, other folks, if you have commentary, the number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound, press *61 if you would like to participate. I did want to make sure I mentioned I had audio segments on it. I posted about it. It was got a lot of attention, and then the governor thing in Virginia became much more of an event. But the black male on Empire, I don't watch the show. Black male, I think he classifies as so-called gay, who was apparently attacked or reportedly attacked in Chicago. And he said it was two males who attacked him, who had Make America Great Again paraphernalia. And I think called him, I think he said a racial slur, and what they call a homophobic slur. And he said he had a rope tied around his neck, has gotten some attention. They had a report. This happened in Chicago. They had a report on WBEZ, which is a Chicago affiliate, where they addressed that a lot of people did not or thought there was something suspicious about this. There's no video of the attack. No one's been arrested. There were, I guess, enough people with suspicion that even WBEZ, which is a NPR affiliate, that they addressed this, people thinking that there was something untoward or maybe he hadn't been truthful. And I think he gave a statement saying that he was 100% factual with enforcement officials. I have no idea what happened. I do know the system of white supremacy primarily operates by deception. I think, or at least one thing that was important, at least for me, on this subject, I think in a system of racism, white supremacy, anytime that a victim of racism, this is a non-white person who was reportedly attacked, anytime a victim of racism reports that they were mistreated and the initial response is, this nigger is lying, I am concerned. Like, until there's evidence that, oh yeah, this person is not being truthful or this didn't happen, unless, you know, there's clear evidence as to why we should not believe this person, I am concerned when non-white people step forward and for any reason say, oh yeah, I'm being mistreated. And the response is, oh yeah, that's not true. Yeah, I don't believe this person for whatever reason, like that, without evidence, unless people have some evidence that, oh yeah, there's some lies being told or we're not getting all the information. And incidentally, I've seen a lot of anti-blackness around this incident with reports and commentary that somehow black people are again homophobic and all of that. I don't even know what that has to do with the reported attack and what have you, but I did see that. That did get a lot of attention as well. I thought the governor situation that took up a little more time to cover, but yes, that did happen this week also. Did we miss anyone? Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, everyone. It's caller from the 712.
I get really, I feel just horrible when I hear about things in the medical field. These people are racist, and then we have to go to them to ask for help because we're sick, and just we should already have it in mind that they might not, you know, more than likely they're not helping. They could very well be harming. And so when the guy showed up to be a blackface Klansman or whatever they were doing, a blackface Klansman, it's just with black people, that's something we really, really need to work on. We have a lot of people that are studying medicine, a lot of black people studying medicine in all fields, whether it be gynecology or pediatrics, all fields. And I know we are very, very, like when it comes to doing stuff like that, like why wouldn't we just say, well, hey, we can't trust these people with taking care of us as far as medicine, so we can go ahead and open up little clinics that black people can go for safe places to get medical treatments. It's just not a safe place, Dr. Wilson. Somebody called in. It's in the archives if anybody want to dig in the archives. A young person called in, and they had a very good question they wanted to know. You know, they asked Dr. Wilson, what should I do if I think my physician is practicing racism? And Dr. Wilson said, you know, you should a good idea would be to maybe, you know, just ask them, you know, have you seen all of the disparities that black people go through in medicine? And I was just wondering, is any of that going to affect my treatment at this doctor, that the doctor that I am today? Do you think that y'all will be practicing racism against me by me even being in here, by me being a black person and needing treatment from y'all? And, you know, I mean, you can do that, and they can say no, but, you know, they could secretly still do it. But I would still ask. When I heard that episode of Cows, I've actually done that and had to switch doctors a couple times, because, like she said, you know, you'll know, because they'll get to shuffling in their seat and be uncomfortable, or if they're honest, they'll just go ahead and tell you, you know, we know, we read the medical journals too, so we know that there's a lot of things going on with racism in medicine, and we here at this doctor's office, we try to guard against that. But again, you know, with the medicine, you know, a good idea would be for like what you're doing now, Gus. You've changed your eating habits. You've changed, you know, how you exercise. And so that'd be a great combat to that if we can just maybe stop eating all the junk. Not maybe, if we could stop eating all the junk, get exercising in. I know I have an aunt that's like 83 years old, and she's been walking ever since she was about 25 years old. This woman walks at least a mile a day. This woman is in perfect health. All she was doing was walking every day. She really never was a crazy eater, so that helped too. But just by her going and taking walks every night, a lot of that stuff we can try to avoid even going to the doctor, just by eating right and exercising, trying to eat correctly and exercising. And another thing I wanted to say was at my other job, taking care of my children, my son came home a couple days ago, and he said, you know, our history teacher wants us to write a paper, Mom. And he's like, Mom, I want you to sit down, because I know you try to counter racism every day, so I want you to have a seat so you don't fall over. But I'm going to tell you what he wants us to write about. So I'm like, okay, son, go ahead. Well, he wants the children to write about the positive aspects of slavery. And I was like, I'm not surprised. I would be surprised if you came home and you didn't tell me something like that was happening in the history class. And so all of the non-white black students in the class are like, I'm not writing anything about it. I'm not going to do it. But I told my son that he definitely should write about it, you know, just what positive aspects was it for slavery. You know, white people still are in charge. positive aspect for them. That's one. The list goes on and on about positive aspects for white people, none for black people. So he wrote a page, and I went up there and asked the teacher, you know, what was that all about? What do you mean positive aspects about slavery? Were you talking about positive aspects for white people? And, of course, he played, you know, oh, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean it like that. So, you know, education in America, as far as black people, forget about it. But man, thanks for doing the cows. I've been having a lot of trouble. I usually keep up with cows and the book sessions by going to the podcast, and I download it. But Apple is, you know, they just refuse to deal with it anymore. So you must be doing something right, Gus, because Apple won't do your podcast anymore. So, but thank you so much for letting me speak. I appreciate it. And y'all have the best night you can.
Yes, SoundCloud is up to date. The book club, Incidents in the Life is there. Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Knot is there. Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, all at SoundCloud, YouTube, Black Talk Radio Network, iTunes, the feed I went to upload. I thought I had made progress and got some of the content uploaded, and then it was not playing, or it would play like 30 seconds of it. That's what even someone wrote in this week and said, that it would play like 8 minutes of the audio, and then it wouldn't play the rest of it, even though the full audio segment was uploaded. Like, continuing with the disruptions at the iTunes feed, but we are available at SoundCloud, the archives, SoundCloud, YouTube, Black Talk Radio Network, Google Play, a variety of other outlets where the archives are available and current. Let's see. Are there other folks? Oh, Bravo with the counter-racist parenting and having your child prepared for that question. Outstanding. Absolutely outstanding work. That's what we should be doing as attempted counter-racist parents. Again, you know, let's try to not have our children in those schools if we can, and making that plan before we, you know, conceive. But absolutely do your best so that they can be prepared and knowledgeable about the enemies that they will face in the classroom from their peers and from the instructors. As for the eating, that is why the Cow's 10-year anniversary retreat, plant-based eating and doing yoga, exercise, and just trying to do the best to eat in a correct manner, I think can be very, should be viewed as black self-respect and counter-racism, because racists, they intend for us to be in poor health so that they can medical apartheid, they can send us to the coon man. Do we have any other folks who had commentary they wanted to share? We have about 6 minutes left in the broadcast.
Can I add one more thing, Gus?
Thomas in New York.
Yes, sir. You know, and I'm going to invoke VVQ privileges here regarding the case. Now, sometimes I just have to use logic. And I've been, you know, I live in the New York area. It gets pretty cold. Today, Tuesday, I was talking to my friend in Chicago, and he was letting his dogs outside, and he said he had to let, he breeds dogs, so he has quite a few. He had to let them out 5 minutes at a time because they'll start tipping around because the ground was so cold. At the night that this happened, and, you know, it could be just some extremely dedicated whites, but it was 40 below with the wind chill factor. I know for sure one thing is no fitted hat going to stay on your head. It's impossible. Your hoodie is flying off of you. I mean, you can't even hold your hoodie down with a tie in that type of weather. And to be walking around with bleach and a noose, and I mean, it just, that just seems like these was either some very extremely dedicated white people who don't feel cold weather, or it just doesn't add up to me.
Certainly, VGQ. I will wait until there's any evidence. And that's why I use the language, reported, alleged, same way that I would report anything else. just with a victim of racism until there's some evidence that this is a hoax. I will reserve judgment. But VGQ, do we have any other folks who had commentary that they wanted to share?
Yes.
Yeah, you can proceed, yes. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Sorry about that. We were talking about the, you know, the word coon, and there's a school, they, white people, they know best. Ferris State University, they have a Jim Crow Museum and the history between Sanborn Coon. And the coon is the black person who was unhappy being a slave but didn't do anything about it or something like that. The ones that we talk about in the book that kind of supposedly sass the master or something like that. But there was a restaurant, I don't know if you heard this, called the Coon Chicken Inn. Couldn't believe it. Well, I can't believe it, but, you know. It was in the 20s, and, of course, they went out of business, not because they weren't making any money, but because of the change in attitudes, like this is not a popular thing to say, so we have to go out of business. They only opened 3 out of the 4 restaurants, but one, the first one was in Salt Lake City, Utah, where all the black people originated. Then another one in Lake City, Seattle, you know, Seattle, Washington, another just enclave of, you know, black history. And then the Hollywood District of Portland, Oregon, the state in the Constitution that didn't want black people, but they want this caricature and all of that. Now, this was in the 20s and 30s. They, of course, they all closed. The one in Seattle is now occupied by the Growler Guys restaurant. I don't know if you've heard of that, but that's what it is now. One is a parking lot, and one is was converted to another restaurant. So, again, we talk a lot about in the South, a place where there hardly any black people, they knew to use these references in their restaurants. Coon Chicken Inn. Fantastic.
Much obliged. If you all check, there is a, it's not a document, it's like a parody film called Confederate States of America. Spike Lee was involved with the project, I think, like in the financing. And it's a parody if the Confederacy had won the Civil War, what the so-called United States might be like. And they're being funny, but then when you get to the end, like they show commercials and what television would look like, just, you know, how would the classrooms look? What would the landscape look like if the Confederacy had won? And so in that, they have a commercial for the Coon Chicken Inn. And so then you get to the end and you realize that about half of the things that they've shown, these are not jokes. These are real things that either do exist or did exist at some point, the Coon Chicken Inn being one. And they have an advertisement and they show some of the restaurants and they even show, yes, one was here in Seattle. I didn't see this film until I had moved to Seattle. So, of course, I cracked up laughing that they had a Coon Chicken Inn right here in Seattle. Yes. But that's fine. I didn't know that they had one also in Portland. That's excellent point about the white people not being ignorant about racism and environments where they have, according to state mandate, forbidden black people, but they still are elated about the Coon Chicken Inn. The black male caller who yielded the floor.
Yes, sir. This is Amadi C. I was going to speak again about the paradox that people talk about that we are in, that we can't end white supremacy yet. That, like, because something negative will happen. So there's a lot of black people who will say that, oh, we can't end white supremacy yet because, well, what about all the factories that are currently running? You know, what, black people won't be able to run those. What about all of the farms? We'll all starve. So we're in a paradox. We can't quite end white supremacy yet. My son is still in the school that I wanted him to go to. You know, he's almost finished. And white people keep saying that, you know, they're they're against white supremacy, but they can't end it yet. They can't leave yet. They can't leave America. They can't do it. They can't do it tonight. They can't do it tomorrow. They can't do it in a year. They don't know when they can end white supremacy. We're in a paradox. They just can't end it. So this is ridiculous. And we absolutely have to end white supremacy immediately. So I just have to say it. I do think that it's imperative. It's very important. We are not in a paradox that we cannot end white supremacy. It has to be ended. Thank you.
Got cut off again, I guess.
Oh, I was muted. I was muted. Sorry. Just got muted that time. Absolutely. I just said Dr. Wells, and she believed that this problem can be solved. She did not think it was a waste of her time to go and talk to all the folks that she did and do lectures and write books. If the problem couldn't be solved, we can do this. She believed we could do this. I think it's just a matter of getting more people who have an accurate understanding of exactly the nature of the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child, dedicated to terrorizing black people forever. With that, we will conclude. Again, for folks, if you're interested in the yoga retreat, untiljustice@gmail.com, constructive eating, plant-based diet for the time that we're there, doing yoga, constructive exchange of views on white supremacy, racism. Looking forward. Virginia, probably have a moment or two to talk about Governor Koonman Northam as well. But untiljustice@gmail.com for details about the retreat. I think we have about 5 spots left. Thanks to everyone who participated. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening. Check Black Talk Radio Network and the Facebook page for upcoming broadcasts. With that, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Racists, they have tricked a lot of black people who were not thinking correctly because we were under the influence. Their poisons, narcotics. Dr. Welsing would want us to preserve our brain computers so that we can think to the best of our ability to solve the problem, white supremacy, racism. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.